This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Place to Be Nation. It is that time once again for Conversation Comics with Todd Weber. This is my first show in a couple of months. I did a show in August, and then it's been buckus from Conversation Comics. I've been, well, let's just say the start of the school year is always kind of a mess in the Weber household. We've got two school-age boys, and one of them is having trouble adjusting to the start of the new year. But we think we've got it under control. Nonetheless, it's been a long time. It's been a long time. It's been a long, lonely, 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 long time. How are you? This is a week after the presidential election. We have a new president-elect, and what can I say? I'm not going to get too political on here. I'm just going to say it was a tough, tough election for a lot of people, and if it was an easy choice for you to select your candidate, then God bless you, because it wasn't for me. I'll leave it at that. Meanwhile, we're moving on as a country. Let's just do it together. Let's take care of each other and look out for everybody. Okay? Okay. What's new with me in my personal life? Well, let's see. Last week, we went and saw Temple of the Dog. Checked something off my bucket list. I didn't even know that was a checkpoint on my bucket list. That was a band I thought would never play a live show, and yet they did. They're doing a small tour, and my wife and I went to San Francisco on Friday night and saw them. It was fantastic. There was no Eddie Vedder, but the crowd was implored to sing the Eddie Vedder parts on Hunger Strike, and it went well. The rest of the set was very good. Lots and lots of not just Temple of the Dog, but also Mother Love Bone, which was basically Pearl Jam with a different singer. And when Andrew Wood, who was the singer for Mother Love Bone, OD'd on heroin, a lot of things happened. It was a creative, it was a very bad point for the Seattle rock community, but a lot of big creative things happened, including Temple of the Dog, which is a tribute record to Andrew Wood, which is basically Mother Love Bone, but with Chris Cornell, who was Andrew Wood's roommate, in as the vocalist. And so that came out of it, and then meanwhile Pearl Jam was happening, and then at the same time Cameron Crowe made a movie basically about Andrew Wood called Singles, one of my favorite films. Really works as a snapshot of 1992 Todd Weber life. I was very much like the Cliff Poncier character. Actually, it was kind of a cross between a lot of the characters. Hopeless romantic, struggling musician, guy with a lot of Joe jobs, trying to make it work. So, yeah, Singles is a great movie. I have a lot of affinity for that early 90s Seattle grunge thing. I know there are some people who aren't fans of it, but it changed music forever, and that's something we have to acknowledge. This show is an interview with my good friend Tim Capel, whom I've never met, but we are good friends nonetheless. So the first half, we get together and we talk about his history in comics and how he became a comics fan and some of the shared memories that he and I have growing up, even though he's about 10 years younger than I am. That tends to be the case. Most of the people I'm friends with happen to be about 10 years younger than I am. Take from that what you will, whether it's my maturity level or my financial level or whatever. I just have always been more comfortable with people who are a little bit younger than me. Doesn't mean I have to be older than everybody else. It just means I don't feel myself or as comfortable with people my own age. Don't know what it is about that. It's like the Groucho Marx line. I would never want to belong to a club that would have me as a member. So Tim and I talk about his background in comics and things he and I both share. But in the second half of the show, we talk about one of the Halicon runs of comics. We're talking Prestige, something that changed comics forever for the better, and upped the ante. And that is the John Byrne, Chris Claremont era of Uncanny X-Men from the late 70s to the early 80s. We run long, so we're going to split that into a few parts, but we still get to check it out in depth. We go over the first dozen or so issues tonight. And also, we'd like you to check out all the other great shows on Place to Be Nation Pop. First and foremost, the weekly journey to the land of comics, that is the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I have the pleasure of working on that show a bit, and I got to tell you, it's an honor and a pleasure to always see what Greg and Nick are bringing to you from their studios in Vancouver, British Columbia. Here on Place to Be Nation Pop, we have other shows, excellent shows. Russell and Kelly with Seller's Points is a great comic show. Geek and Sassy is an outstanding show. Also loved to see what they're doing, bringing in new guests. And it's nice that there's a different perspective. I wonder if one of our shows, maybe we can start. I don't think I would be able to get away with some of the things that they get away with talking about. Let's just leave it at that. My wife, I don't think, would be cool with it. So, also on Place to Be Nation Pop, we've got Lucia Undead, we've got Top Beer, we've got the NBA Weekly podcast with Andrew Reich. That's a great show, too. So, PTBN Pop is blowing up. I'm proud to be part of it. Also, if you'd like to help us, help the network, go to placetobenation.com, click on our Amazon link. Specifically, if you're looking for something that's relevant to this show, go to the Amazon link and search Essential X-Men 1. That is a large collection of black and white X-Men comics. Starting in the late 70s, it's kind of the modern era of X-Men that changed comics as we know them, for the better, of course. And you should be able to get that for about $10 through our Amazon affiliate. And Place to Be Nation picks up a little bit of chump change for that. Helps us pay the bills. So, with all that in mind, I'd like to introduce my guest today. He is part of WCW Survey Says, which is a podcast on the regular Place to Be Nation feed. He's also an author, a writer, a blogger on comics podcasts. He is the Dark Passenger himself, Tim Capel.
Tim, how are you?
Todd, I am doing excellent. Great to be here podcasting with you coast to coast. You're out in Northern California, am I right?
You are correct, and you are in you're on the East Coast in the Commonwealth of Virginia, if I am
the Commonwealth, mistaken. One of the few Commonwealths. Yeah, I'm in Central Virginia, so we could not be as further apart in the United States, probably.
Are you off of I-80, or where does that go? That goes to Maryland, I think.
Yeah, I mean, not far from I-80. It's not part of my typical commute. I'm more like I-95, which takes you up into kind of the Northern Virginia counties in the D.C. area. But I-80, I mean, it's certainly not far from me, just sort of in a different direction. But I'm in Richmond or suburbs thereabouts, so everything's pretty easily accessible. You're never more than about an hour and a half from a beach, so that's always nice.
Nice. So yeah, I mentioned I-80 because I live right off of I-80, and that's a coast to coast freeway. So that's
okay,
kind of cool.
Great.
Interstate. So we are connected via. If someone wanted to just drive and drive for the 3.5 days or so it would take to get there, you could just without having to worry about Waze or your Apple navigation too much. So
very good. I'll keep that in mind if the wanderlust strikes me one day.
So you are in your mid-30s or so?
Yeah, I'm I just turned 33. I did have to think about it there, but in September, yeah, I'm 33. So not, you know, I've been reading comics basically my entire life, so I'm not sure generationally where that puts me necessarily, because I have been reading comics for as long as I can remember, but that is still kind of longer than other people my age, I feel like.
Do you have an earliest comic book memory or superhero memory that resonates?
I don't know that I really do, because I've told this story before, I think on Seller's Points not too long ago. So shout out to Russell.
Hey, Russ.
Soft plug there. Like to get those in whenever possible, because he does great work as well. So I can't remember a time in my life when comics were not a part of that, you know, just sort of day-to-day existence in some form or another. Even before I could read, I feel like I had comics or had access to comics, certainly was interested in comics. I think it started with just the general overall interest in superheroes that you develop as a young kid. I mean, what little kid doesn't like Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, the usual suspects? So, you know, this would have been, I was born in 1983. So, you know, we're talking the mid 80s. This stuff is pretty pervasive in the culture, back then, not to the extent it is now, of course, but I mean, you're familiar with Superman as a character, even if you don't know he's a comic book character. So, I mean, this stuff was always, it feels like, around me, in the form of toys, games. I was a big action figure junkie growing up, for a long time.
Like Superpowers figures, or the line right after that.
I was just thinking of Superpowers. I didn't have a whole lot of them myself, but I have a cousin who's a year and just a couple days older than me, and he had a ton of action figures, and most of the Superpowers line. He even had some of the Secret Wars toys put out by Mattel, which I don't know how he came into those, because I feel like they were produced like around the time we would have been, gosh, 1, 2, maybe 3 years old. So,
right. Who knows how store stocks would go through, or, you know, would Iron Man and Doctor Doom still be on the shelves for years and years at a time? Or
I was just about to say those were the two. Those were the two I can recall offhand actually having these kind of crappy rubber, barely articulated Dr. Doom and Iron Man toys from that Secret Wars line.
Who else did they have? They had Wolverine. I remember that figure. There was obviously Spider-Man.
Yeah, Wolverine had Magneto. Snap on claws, I recall.
That was the very first Wolverine figure.
Yep, sure was. You had Spider-Man and both of his costumes.
Right.
He had just debuted the black costume in that miniseries. So they did both versions, so that was kind of cool.
Did they have a Cap figure?
They did have a Cap figure, and he had a really awful, terrible shield, which is funny because all of those action figures, if I remember, they came with like a shield that was just sort of there with their logo on it.
It had a lenticular thing where it would have their secret identity if you tilted it one way, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So Dr. Doom had a shield. Wolverine had a shield, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just their action, because they didn't do anything. They didn't have like superpowers. You moved it some way and they would do a Hitler salute or something. Flash's legs would kind of move. Aquaman would kind of
swing.
Squeeze
the legs and Superman starts new stuffing.
Ubermensch. But the Secret Wars figures just had, you know, bending at the waist, and not the waist, the hips and the shoulders, I think, and you could turn the head. I remember them pretty well. But
I do too, surprisingly.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have many of them. It's just I remember what that line was like. And it's funny, you mentioned the crappy lenticular shields that they all came with. That was for Cap, you know, that was actually bigger than the actual shield that they gave him. I think they gave him his own shield. They might not have even given him his own shield, to be honest.
That would be really cheesy if one of the lenticular faces just had the red, white, and blue circles in the star. Like, this is his shield, and then, I don't know. It was a weird toy design. Nobody had capes, so you had Doctor Doom without a cape, Magneto without a cape.
Mm-hmm. And they looked kind of naked without them. It was very strange. But the Superpowers toys, they had, I believe, nice, like, little cloth capes. Which you could snap on. I might be thinking of a later line.
I think like Robin and Batman did detachable capes. All those guys.
That seems to be what I remember. So, I mean, those things, and that was the first time you had characters like Dr. Fate getting an action figure. So some of these lesser known or less visible characters in the DC stable were well represented.
Even Hawkman. I remember the big Hawkman wings. And it was cool. Even Green Lantern and Flash, those were their first figures too, because they weren't part of the Mego lines.
Right, And that Mego was a different animal too, where they were, you know, those weren't really the types of action figures I was into. And
they're more dolls.
they couldn't really properly be described as action figures, could they?
Yeah, they weren't like the G.I. Joe or Star Wars where you would pose them and set up battle scenes or anything. The Migos, as cool as they are, and I have a ton, they're not as posable as you'd hope, and they're not as playable as you'd hope. You just kind of – they look nice and they stand. They're kind of boy Barbies for the most part.
Sure.
But yeah, it's okay if girls play with them too.
I suppose. So won't rule that out.
Right on.
So, you know, I guess it kind of started with primarily action figures and then realizing that these characters were actually published in comic books. And it's like, well, what's a comic book? And it's, again, this is all coming from my cousin who we basically grew up together.
Okay.
And I don't actually have any blood siblings of my own, so we were kind of like brothers growing up. And he's like, well, you know, they're kind of like magazines, but smaller, and you know, they have words with pictures, basically. And I'm like, you know, not really understanding the concept. And this is probably before either one of us can really meaningfully even read.
Sure.
So you kind of just flip through them and look at the pretty pictures, but it was cool. I mean, it was just one of those making a discovery like that was just really cool and really novel as a kid. And I want to say that the first, I don't know why I'm thinking this, but the first comic I can remember actually seeing, putting my hands on, and it was, again, something that my cousin Ryan had in his possession. It had to have been an issue of Superman, or I don't know, maybe some DC, random DC team up book from the 80s, but it had Superman and Firestorm on the cover.
Okay.
And
probably a DC Comics Presents comic then?
That's sort of what I'm thinking. Yeah.
Pre-Crisis.
It could have been a Firestorm comic, actually. I don't know. But I think it was more – I don't know why he would have had a random Firestorm comic.
I think Firestorm, actually, at least the first 25 issues or so were fairly popular because I bought them at the time, and I can remember it being tied in somewhat with, again, Superpowers and Super Friends. So Firestorm was maybe being positioned a little bit like a Spider-Man teenage hero for DC at the time. And it was fairly popular in 82, 83 or so. But I think it's more likely it was a DC Comics Presents just because you'd see Superman teaming up with the Hero of the Week in there. And he had at least two of them where it was Superman and Firestorm. And it was it was like the DC equivalent of Marvel Team Up or Brave and the Bold, which would be Batman with a character.
Right. So it had to be something along those lines. And I mean, I think we both knew Firestorm. We certainly knew who Superman was, but Firestorm, I mean, he got an action figure too. So it's like we were familiar with these characters, and you know, he just kind of had random one-off issues like that. And from there, I guess it was probably trading cards.
Right. I was going to ask if the Marvel cards of 1990 or so, you had a memory of those.
So that became a big thing with the Marvel trading cards, several series of those. That first series was a little bit...
It wasn't Cosmic cards. That's a DC thing, DC Cosmic
that was,
cards.
Well, I had those too.
Yeah.
Was that the series where they actually had the gold and silver and modern age versions?
Yeah, I believe so, the DC. Mm-hmm. But the Marvel, that Marvel line, it was a weird time for Marvel because you didn't have a proper X-Men team.
Exactly. I was about to say the same thing.
Spider-Man had his Captain Universe powers, so they showed Spider-Man is flying. They had an Aunt May card, which I remember those cards had stats on the back of them. You know, percentage of battles won. It was almost like a role-playing game or so. If you're looking for that, it would try to quantify their powers and keep track of their battles and things. So Aunt May's, instead of battles won or enemies vanquished, it said wheat cakes served.
Yes, successful wheat cake recipe. Yeah, I think Stan Lee had a card in there.
That's right. I do remember that had like little features of each hero on that card.
And the, like you said, the win loss, I think they even had ties, and it was all very arbitrary. Of course, I don't know where they were pulling the stuff from. I guess I can picture, you know, Peter Sanderson or somebody like that sitting down and actually researching all this.
Elliot R. Brown, you know, one of the Marvel stat nerds. And Marvel was kind of a mess.
Or somebody.
Yeah, they were a bit of a mess at that point. So, and you could have something like that wouldn't necessarily tie into editorial, or it'd be based on, you know, a year or so ago, and a lot of things could change in the Marvel universe in a year back then.
Right, because you have to figure these things were probably developed in 1989. I think they actually hit the stands in probably 90.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the state of the Marvel publishing line in 1989, Jim Shooter had been ousted as editor-in-chief. He was gone.
Was it
like
DeFalco after that?
Yeah, Shooter was gone like mid-87, I want to say. DeFalco was in, but you got to figure he's still kind of trying to get settled in. And a lot of the major series, they were doing this kind of weird biweekly publication on many of their highest selling titles, where during the summer, you know, you'd get two books a month for stuff like X-Men and mm-hmm. Wolverine.
Right. During certain
Captain
times
America.
Of year, yeah, you'd have now twice a month or now biweekly for certain storylines. It wasn't all the time, though. And then you have annuals, too.
Yeah, and of course, you still had the annuals going on. So there was really a glut of product out there, but this is still pre-X-Force, pre-McFarlane Spider-Man, pre-X-Men relaunch 91.
You had the Wolverine spinoff title, the patch title, just started up, I think.
Yeah, and that was kind of a mess for a while, too. Where it was a little bit aimless. They weren't quite sure what they were doing with it. Cycled through a lot of creative teams. So it was a weird time in Marvel's existence. You're right. There wasn't a proper X-Men team, but they still had a trading card because each all the major teams did get like a spotlight and a trading card. And the X-Men card was just random scattered characters who had been X-Men.
Except for one. There was one guy who had never been an X-Men who was on there and had no business being on that card.
I think I know who you're talking about.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, actually, I might have two answers because was it Sunder from...
Well, it was Strong Guy. It was a strong guy from who ended up being an X Factor later, but he was in New Mutants. He was a character as a bodyguard for Lila Cheney at that point.
Lila, yes.
We'd never even seen him before in X-Men proper. But on the back, he was listed as Sunder, or at least Sunder, who was a Morlocks character, was listed. Yeah, just weird.
I couldn't remember. It was one or the other. I couldn't remember who was actually fictional well, versus both. How they were. Yes. So, God, I can't believe we both remember.
And that's just a weird editorial glitch, I think, where, you know, one hand doing. Or maybe that was Claremont's plan down the road, was to put Sunder in the X-Men team, and it just
that's
evolved.
The thing. You wonder how much of this reflected intent versus just, let's take a stab at it because we don't know and we don't have a clear answer forthcoming. I think Havoc was in there and he'd been off the team for a couple years. He was still in limbo and didn't pop up until that that Extinction Agenda crossover, which was kind of nuts.
Was that okay? I'm trying to think where. He and Polaris were both in limbo, right?
Yeah, Polaris. Well, she was kicking it on Muir Island with Sunder.
Okay.
the Muir Island X-Men. That was when she had lost her magnetic powers and inexplicably gained super strength. And she had really big hair, almost Wolverine-esque hair. And she was like 7 feet tall. And you know, she may have even been listed as a member on that trading
card. I'll have to
think
see.
About
it. I maybe I'll Google it during the break and see, but yeah, I mean, it's those cards. Did you try to amass a set and put them in binders or anything like that?
No, at that point I didn't. With that series, I did not. I think I mostly came into them through, they would be packaged with, some of the Toy Biz action figures, which came out, I want to say 90, 91, that first wave of Toy Biz X-Men figures, which are kind of shaky.
They are. Yeah, I remember many a trip to the KB Toy Store in the mall, and there were big, blocky Toy Biz figures.
Toy Biz was going to block them off. They improved significantly, made a pretty big leap from that first series of Toy Biz, that first line to the second. They made some course corrections really for the best. But they would come packaged with a trading card from that first series. So that's really how I encountered that particular line of trading cards. I think it was series two where I was like, all right, now I am all in. Because that's when you got the power ratings, right?
Yeah.
So you got to compare Galactus with his agility of one versus Spider-Man with his agility of seven and have these imaginary battles and arguments, debates on the playground, which Greg Phillips has talked about having many showdown with his friends over the consternation over these power ratings.
I think as you're a young kid, you latch onto the characters and the powers, but not necessarily the stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the gateway is you pick up these stats, right? And you put a lot of stock in it. Like, this is gospel, you know, this is, you have no reason to question it because you're not coming at it from any real context.
No.
This is all new to you. So of course, Gambit only has a strength rating of one for whatever reason. He seems like a real weakling. And, I never understood why Captain America seemed to be rated so low when he was like such this great fighter and was on par with Wolverine, could go toe to toe with Wolverine and the great martial artists of the Marvel Universe in the comics themselves. But you look at his power ratings and it's like, kind of tops out at two on everything.
Yeah. They would always say he was the pinnacle of unenhanced humanity.
Yes.
Like, you, exactly. As strong as a human being could possibly be without an X, you know, an X factor. Right. At the same time, I was reading and collecting the Marvel Superheroes role-playing game from TSR, which had similar ratings for everybody. So you could see not only their strength and their agility, but also their intuition and stuff like that.
So, yeah, for whatever that's worth, right?
Right, right. Well, you're setting up these campaigns, and I never played it. I bought the game. It was like I played a couple of roles of D&D, and then I thought, oh, that would be interesting to get into, and you're all by yourself. You're not going to set up a campaign for an RPG. So, mm-hmm. But I liked the series, and it had a lot of cool burn and guys like that art on the character cards. And that was what it was all about for me, was just reading the bios of the characters and the power ratings and things like that.
And yeah, that it seems like a thing that should have happened, right? A proper Marvel role-playing type game, because mm-hmm. that was, I don't know, I guess D&D had sort of already had its heyday by then.
It was mostly, D&D got into E.T. the movie in 82, and it was pretty well-known, pretty established at that point. They did a DC role-playing game, you know, pen and paper with the board and everything, and they did a Marvel one too, but neither of them captured everybody's imagination like D&D did.
Right, right. Of course, you had, what was it, in the kind of mid-90s, Overpower, was that a thing? Which was just a kind of a trading card set. It was a more like Magic the Gathering than D&D, but I remember that amassing a bit of a cult following. And ran for had a good little run there, but I never got particularly into that. But anyway, just one of those media platforms that they didn't seem to penetrate as much as they wanted to.
There weren't, you know, a whole lot of cartoons in the late 80s at that point. I'm trying to think.
Nope.
Post Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, when was the last? When did we get another cartoon? Was it X-Men in 92?
It must have been. I mean, they had Pride of the X-Men.
Right, but the pilot.
The pilot. But not a whole lot of people, I think, saw that. I don't think that made much of an impression, certainly not a positive one, on those who did see it. So, I mean, yeah, honestly, it was. I mean, you had the Batman animated series, but for Marvel, it didn't start until X-Men, which was Halloween of 92.
Yeah, everybody points to 92 because that, you know, they have the tie-in with the comic now. But it was a really dry time for superheroes and other media. And
yeah, it sort of was.
You had the Hulk movies that every few years would be on NBC.
Yep, and you know what? I saw one of those. I saw a trial of the Incredible Hulk.
Ah, yeah, Rex Smith as Daredevil.
Right.
From Solid Gold.
Yes, so that was and by the way, it seems like the costume design there, the Netflix series sort of borrowed a little bit.
Yeah, it was pretty much it. The black mask with the tie, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was, looked a little bit better with the Netflix budget.
Well, but, everything about the Netflix one was better. Those Hulk movies just got worse and worse. I think they did too. They did the Daredevil one and they did the Thor one.
Yeah, the Thor one. I want to say there was one more. Death of the Incredible Hulk.
I don't know if they had anybody else. Did they bring another character into it or not? I mean, these are all Googleable things, but.
Yeah, I don't think I've even seen that one, actually. I know I've seen the Thor one and certainly Trial with Daredevil. Oddly enough, no Trial in that movie. It was a dream sequence.
Really? It's all just a dream.
Yeah, with Stan Lee as, I think, a juror. He might have been the foreman of the jury. But anyway, that was your obligatory Stan Lee cameo.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Go ahead.
There was a Hulk cartoon in the 80s that I had totally blanked on. I knew there were Fantastic Four cartoons and a Herbie the Robot, and then there was a Thing solo title or solo cartoon. But there was
you're right, a
Hulk TV show that came on halfway through or second or third year into Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, which was kind of the flag bearer for Marvel TV for a long time. But I don't remember much about it other than it had Stan Lee vocal introductions to every episode.
Yeah, I forgot about that too. I never really saw it. And I mean, I've maybe come across episodes here and there. You mentioned The Thing. Was that the
Thing Ring, Do Your Thing?
Thing Ring, Do Your Thing. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And he shared a show with the Flintstones. So
okay.
Half of the show would be The Thing, and then the other half would be the Flintstones.
That makes sense. Yeah. Well, it doesn't make sense.
Skinny Ben Grimm who can flip his ring and turn into The Thing, which is not even an accurate character portrayal of Ben Grimm.
You know, no.
Who's like no. Jack Kirby in comic form.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
That's great.
Cool. Right on. Well, when did you start, did you have a local comic shop or hobby shop in the area when you were growing up? Maybe 12 years old?
You know, I want to say I had a few options, surprisingly enough. I think for whatever reason, Richmond was kind of got in as an early adopter of the direct market system. So you would see stores advertise. I don't know if they were just local advertisements or what in the comics themselves, but I feel like anytime you saw advertisements for, you know, specialty comic stores in comics of the 80s, you'd see like Dave's Comics listed, right, which was around for years and years and actually just, I want to say a couple months ago, closed. That wasn't one I went to frequently just because it wasn't like in the neighborhood, but you know, I made a couple stops there. There was a few others, but my go-to was always Richmond Comics. Just, I really liked the people there. They were helpful, friendly, and very much cognizant of the fact that I'm a kid. So kind of treated me with kid gloves. Rather than being a dick about don't touch the stuff.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they could tell they would kind of be looking up from the counter to make sure you're not completely destroying anything. But, I mean, they realized it's a comic shop. You're there to peruse the comics. So they were always, you know, really cool about that. And anytime I had a question, you know, willing to engage, even if it was kind of a dumb kid type of question, which I'm sure they got a lot of. But that was my go-to for years. And that was where, very infamously, the first sustained comic series that I followed was Captain America. I just took a liking to the character primarily from the action figures, from Toy Biz. Toy Biz had a line of just general Marvel superheroes before they did X-Men. So Cap was one of them, from the trading cards that we talked about. I don't know why, I took a shine to Cap.
That had to be the Grunewald era?
That was the Grunewald era. Yeah. It's Grunewald writing with Rick Levins on art.
Hmm.
The late, unfortunately, Rick Levins, Grunewald as well, passed away quite unexpectedly, and gosh, going on 20 years now, right?
So post U.S. Agent or about that same time?
Well, not only post U.S. Agent, but actually we talked about these biweekly, these somewhat...
the Serpent Squad. Right? No, Serpent Society.
Yeah, the Serpent Society in there. It gets a little bit sideways, actually. My first actual comics run that I picked up was Capwolf.
Capwolf, that's what I was hoping you'd go there. Right on.
Yep. Man and Wolf. That's what it was called.
Right on. Right on. Do you still have that run?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Nice. That was... you know, it was Captain America turns into a werewolf for six issues, delivered on the premise. Can't say it was a bait and switch by any means.
It wasn't just a dream, just to justify the title.
Nope. It was it was exactly as advertised. So being the 7-year-old, I guess, that I was at that point, I don't know. That really appealed to me.
Right on.
Grunewald did a lot of weird stuff with like that with Cap. He had one where he just before that, the Superia stratagem where he teased turning Captain America into a woman. And certainly had a little bit of gender bending going on throughout that storyline.
I remember some of the previous runs where you'd have Bernie America, right? Have you ever seen those?
Yes.
His girlfriend at the time, Bernie, dressed up as Cap, but not Steve Rogers becoming Stephanie Rogers.
No, this was, so the idea was, the villain, Superia, wanted to, God, what was the plot of this thing? She gathered up like all of the female supervillains of the Marvel Universe. And so you had major characters and all of these just sort of supporting one-off, barely ever seen characters that Grunewald was so fond of, put them all together in this one story. And she's basically going to, I think, sterilize the populace, and that would shift the balance of power towards women. So she's like this ultra feminist, feminazi, as the term would have been used back then.
Poor guy. Grunewald must have gone through a hell of a breakup to lead into that story.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that came about, but it was goofy. I mean, it was pretty intentionally campy. It didn't seem like he was trying to make any kind of political statement or anything with this. I mean, he knew it was utterly absurd. And it was pretty much played and pitched as such. But that was one that, you know, even before Cap Wolf, that was the one people sort of pointed at and laughed at, turned their noses up at.
Was D-Man a part of the book at that point?
Yes and no. He was sort of out as a regular supporting character, but he would still come back around occasionally before he ultimately got written out for good in a very strange way. But
yeah, I don't think I read Cap on a regular basis until the first Wade run
with Ron Garning.
Right, pre-Heroes Reborn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was a great,
totally derailed the great Captain America stories that Wade had done.
Yeah, that killed a lot of their momentum because they were building up to something that really could have been a classic, and in a lot of people's eyes still is. But yeah, they really got the shaft with Heroes Reborn. I mean, they came back an entire year later once the Heroes Reborn.
And Cap had two books at that point when he came back, I think. One was just a regular Cap title, and one was the Sentinel of Liberty, I think.
Yes.
Title continued the Wade stories.
Yep. And they actually shifted Ron Garney off of the regular Captain America series and put him on Sentinel of Liberty, at least for the first couple of issues, I want to say, and Andy Kubert became the regular Cap artist with Wade, and that, you know, it kind of lost a step there as well.
Yeah, just was editorial derailment. I mean, everything, it was an awesome book that they ended up giving to Liefeld and the Image Universe, which I think we need to do a special PTBN look at Heroes Reborn, the whole thing.
We really should. It's been years since I read any of that stuff, and I'm interested to see how, I don't want to say how it holds up because I know it's not going to hold up because it wasn't any great shakes in the first place.
No. At the time, the perception was that the Avengers and the Cap books were going to be terrible, but the Iron Man and the Fantastic Four books would be awesome.
Uh-huh.
Just Jim Lee's association with him, and you know, we'll have to go back and take a look.
Yeah, I would definitely be down for that. It's such an interesting artifact that they did that. And in a lot of ways, that was sort of a precursor to Marvel Knights, not in terms of quality, mind you, but just the business model.
Right. More creator involvement, more high-profile creators who got more carte blanche.
Yeah, and just farming it out, basically, to almost, like another studio.
Homage, right? Homage.
I guess, whatever. Liefeld and Wildstorm with Jim Lee. I mean, they were still Marvel titles. It's just Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld's respective studios were doing the work. I mean, they were no longer under the auspices of
Image. Yeah. It's weird. I mean, that says a lot about Image, what was happening with Image, where the higher profile guys were kind of splitting off into their own things, where you had Silvestri doing his own thing and Lee doing their own thing.
Right.
But, you know, we digress. You were like 8 years old. What did Image mean to you at the time? cool. Spawn.
Yeah. Image was a non-entity for me at the time, to be honest with you, when it started. I mean, I was aware of it as a kind of newfangled thing, but I wasn't looking at it in terms of, oh no, now all of my favorite artists on the X-Men titles are leaving. I mean, I had no concept of the fact that there were actual people creating these these comics that I'm reading. You know what I mean? I guess I just thought they were assembled, you know, on like a factory floor kind of thing.
Marvel, Team Marvel.
Yeah, just cranked out.
Marvel factory.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I noticed the shift in and you know drop in artistic quality on some level, but it wasn't a conscious thing that I was aware of and following. Because it was, it was sort of a while before I was picking up X-Men regularly. Cap was my first Marvel series that I faithfully followed, at least for a year or so. X-Men, you know, I definitely had that first arc with the relaunch under Jim Lee, which, I mean, everyone had that.
Everybody had, and everybody was buying both books for a while.
Mm-hmm.
About a year and a half or so, if I recall correctly, where you'd buy the Team Blue and the Team Gold. You would buy the Uncanny book and then the X-Men adjective list, as we called it. And yes. You would buy Wizard magazine, too.
Yeah, I didn't start getting Wizard for a while. I would have issues here and there if I, you know, happened upon it, in the grocery store or something. But, I mean, it wasn't something that I was diligent about picking up. I'm now 8-9 years old. I can read, and sort of process this information, but as far as industry news and happenings, it's not really registered yet. I think the first few issues of that Omega Red, introduction, which again is still Jim Lee, but I found that I was missing issues as I came out. So a lot of that was filling in gaps, through back issues. And boy, let me tell you, discovering back issue bins when you're a little kid in a comic shop, I might as well say kid in a candy store, because I mean, just realizing, oh wait, all this stuff that's already come out, you mean I can still buy it?
Right. Did you have I remember the same feeling. Did you have a spiral bound notebook where you'd keep track of your entire inventory?
Not so much a spiral bound notebook, but I would certainly take down, I would have my little list of, my wish list, my want list, my holy grail, which, I mean, for whatever reason, there would be issues that, despite the circulation numbers being what they were in the 90s, you know, through the roof, for whatever reason, it took me forever to track down issue 9 of, as you said it, the adjective list.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Which was a X-Men Ghost Rider crossover with the Brood. And it was actually, when I finally found the issue, I actually really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. But I don't know why. It just took forever to find that.
Pre-internet, man. You were beholden to your local store. And what they would get, what somebody would trade back to them, or what they ended up never selling, you know, would end up in their back issue bins.
Yeah, and that's a great point. It was, you were beholden to your local store, and it was come back, you know, month after month, and of course they still just had the same issues that they had. And so I didn't get it until I went to my first comics convention, which was just a small, it was in like a hotel showroom type of thing that my dad took me to. So that's where I was actually truly able to fill in some gaps for the first time in my then growing collection. Awesome.
Do you remember any of the pros who were at that convention? If there were any?
There were zero pros. Okay. It was just a little local thing with, just a kind of a joint promotion with, I think the local shops in the area. So, I mean, if there were pros, I wouldn't have even known.
You were still like thinking that comics were coming from the companies and not the creators.
I mean, and it wasn't like super crowded or anything, so I don't think they brought in somebody that, you know, anyone was clamoring to see. These were about once every few months they would do one of these things. And I mean, you would hear about it promoted on like public access stations and just local news stations. It's like, oh, there's a comics convention coming up. Can we go to that? And my dad was always really good about supporting my habit, which would later give way to probably an addiction.
Little did they know.
I know. He may have, if he could do it over, it might be a different story.
Well, back then, you know, books were 65 cents to $1.25, and it was no big deal. You know, here you go. Here's my pocket change. Get a couple books at Walden Books, right, in the mall or 7-Eleven. And nowadays it's, I have a $50 a week comics budget. I don't hit that most weeks, but that's what I budget for, just in case.
And when books are $4 and $5 a pop, I mean, that doesn't go real far.
No.
It's a shame.
Thank goodness for Marvel Unlimited, of which we will talk more later. Were you reading any DC at the time, or were you aware of a difference between the two companies?
Yeah, I totally knew there was a Marvel and there was a DC, and the differences between their characters and their universes. I wasn't trying to think. I don't believe I was regularly following any DC titles, although I was all in on Death and Return of Superman, mm-hmm. I should say. Like a lot of kids, that Christmas, the year of Death of Superman, DC did a really smart thing in doing like a mass market trade paperback collection of just the Death of issues. So those, like, you know, 7 issues leading up to
the countdown,
Superman 75. Yeah. And it was like all of $4.95. I mean, it was super cheap.
What a great deal.
Yeah. For the straight paperback. Yeah. So like a lot of kids, I got that just sort of as a stocking stuffer, because that's all you heard about was Death of Superman.
They owned the media with that. It was really all encompassing. Everybody had the armbands. Everybody had bought multiple copies of the book as speculators and you had to have one to read too.
And you're seeing like Mike Carlin and Dan Jurgens on the Today Show. And I mean, it's just unbelievable to think back. That's stuff that I've seen as an adult, and just realizing this was not just national news during like a slow news week sort of thing. But I mean, they're doing interviews with the creators behind it, which that was something you'd never seen before. You'd get press releases, of course, just from the company and kind of the head people in charge. But I mean, they're talking to the individual creators on this thing. And that was really I mean, I'm trying to think of an example where it was that pervasive, in making headlines.
I think only the image, what they tried to do to make a big splash as creators first, was roughly the same time, maybe a little earlier, where you had the MTV, you think of the Image guys and MTV guys, or Rob Liefeld had a
that's right.
Levi's commercial.
Yeah.
So you started seeing the faces and the personalities behind them and like going, oh, okay. So these guys can create something that's just as good that they own that they've, yeah. But it, honestly, you'd rather see the good creator matched up with the good character.
Yeah. The end of the day.
In the end. Yeah. So, but Death of Superman editorially is just an absolute masterpiece, what they ended up doing, how they planned it out, how the attention they got. And even though it's very 90s, very dated, you had the four weekly Superman titles. And for a while, you'd have, you know, every third month, you'd have a fifth one, but it just worked out. And as you progress through the Death of Superman, it became a bigger and bigger deal. You count the number of panels for each page. Did you notice that at the time? Where as they got closer, it was so cool. It was just very, very smart.
It was something that didn't register on a conscious level at first, but maybe the second or third time through reading it, it was like, oh, wait a minute. There's now all of a sudden we've gone from, you know, six panels a page to four to now two to now everything's a splash page. And yeah, that was something that it was like, oh yeah, I see. And that's one of the great strengths of comics as a medium, to be able to just that blend of you know the visual aspect and the story that you're actually reading on the page that you can't find in anything else. And it's hard to, I think, make someone appreciate that without them having experienced it firsthand. For me to describe that to someone, it's kind of like, okay, big deal. I don't really get it. But, you know, as a comics reader, that's one of the things that keeps you in the game, I think, is just seeing how innovative the medium can be over just other forms of entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at what the artists can do and how they can tell a story without any words. And then you add if it's a really good plot or a really good script, it adds so much more to it. I can think of, did you ever go back and read the Justice League International run?
A little bit. Yeah. The DeMatteis and Giffen stuff.
Right. With Kevin Maguire mostly on art, where
primarily
you had Giffen would do these breakdowns of 9-panel pages that would tell the basic story, and then Maguire would just do his classic facial expressions and it, you know, so funny and so good. And those are comics that will always hold up for me, even though it kind of sputtered out right before ironically, the Death of Superman, where Jurgens ended up taking over the book, and it kind of Justice League kind of had its time of entropy where it just fell apart again. But
it's funny you mentioned that. I want to read more of that. I want to read like that entire sustained run because I kind of had the poor man, what I think of as the poor man's version of that, which was Peter David's X-Factor after the big X-Men relaunch of the early 90s.
Right.
Where the model was kind of similar where it's sort of silly, goofy stories, but then all of a sudden shit would get real. And just that sort of tonal whiplash that you would get from time to time that blended the serious and the comedic all at once and so very well. But I think Justice League International probably would have been the standard bearer for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I love those Peter David, Larry Stroman. Oh, hey, your phone. You hit your phone.
Yes.
I have that phone. Hey, baby. So I have that same run of X-Factor. I was reading, all four of the X-books at that point. Was it four? Was there X-Force 2?
Yeah, X-Force was actually the one that kicked it all off. That started 2 months before the new X-Men number one. Of course, you had Uncanny, which got a new creative team, and yeah, X-Factor.
And they flipped Excalibur. New Mutants into... Yeah, that's right. I forget about Excalibur, because it always felt very disconnected from the other four.
It was. It wasn't even under, like, the proper X-Men editorial office, so to speak. So it was, for a while, pretty disconnected. And you had Wolverine solo series, which started to be brought more into the fold under Larry Hama and Mark Silvestri before he split for Image. They were doing some pretty exciting work on that title. Then you had
around the 50s or so, 40s or 50s. Yeah, I recall. Exactly. And you started seeing the more of the backstory showing up, and then. But then Silvestri split, and Wolverine, it kind of floundered for a while. I remember was it 75 he got the adamantium pulled out, or was that something? Am I?
Well, yeah, it happened in X-Men 25. That was the Fatal Attractions, and Wolverine 75 was the follow up to that.
Okay.
That was the big reveal of the bone claws.
Right on. Go ahead.
Adam Kubert was the artist, which he was, he's kind of underrated, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And is the better of the Kubert artists.
they're distinctive. Brothers. Yeah. And he gets more press. He's doing, you know, Dark Knight stuff. But I always liked Adam too. And he did more of the, the quieter stories, maybe a little bit more traditional look to his things. And he was more like Romita, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Adam had some crazy layouts that he was doing on Wolverine at the time, like stuff that you didn't see in traditional superhero comics, where it's like these really stacked layouts where the storytelling is still pretty easy to follow. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it would just be going all over the page. Just the, you hear about things like economy of line and all the stuff that you look for if you're analyzing something artistically. But I mean, he was wildly experimentative still within the house style, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It was really not like anything else. Not like any other art you're seeing in Marvel books at that time.
Yeah. I know the era pretty well, but just because my friend Tom ended up drawing, I believe, 77. Do you have that one? You know, the Wolverine 77.
Oh, are you talking about Tom Coker?
Yeah, he inherited this. He got to do a one-shot, and so he had this great print run, and it was a great royalty.
That's for awesome for him. Yeah. Wow, that's if you ever did just a one-off
I know.
issue.
What a great stroke of luck to do.
Time to do it. Good
do you have any him. Other favorite artists, Tim?
Favorite artists. I think I've mentioned before how big of a Walt Simonson mark that I am. Going back to his Thor, he did some pretty fine work on X Factor once that turned into a more readable series, which it wasn't for
kind
a while.
Of the second era of X Factor. You had the, trying to think, it was more the Against Apocalypse, that era.
Yeah, so like their first six issues were really rough. That's when they were doing, like, they were pretending to be mutant hunters, right. While they were actually rescued. It was just weird and not good. But Louise Simonson then came in, started writing it, and turned it around. And then Simonson came in on, well, her husband, Walt Simonson, at that point, came in on art after he had just wrapped up his Thor run. So that was all really – and that went through, like, the Inferno crossover, where Walt was really able to cut loose on some visuals. So he had a nice little run on that. And, I mean, I've just always admired him as a pure superhero artist. He's very influenced by Jack Kirby in terms of his kind of design aesthetic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the big supersized panels and, you know, big figures that dominate most of the panel with foreshortening. I like Simonson a lot too, but it's interesting because after Orion, where is he gone? I don't see him anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. I you know, he could be largely retired at this point. If that's the case, he certainly earned it. George Perez, I mean, you know, how can you not mention George Perez in any discussion about superhero comics?
People know that he's my favorite, and just he was kind of the first artist I ever noticed that the art stood out to. But I remember buying the Thor, maybe might have been 375 or 350 actually in eighth grade, 1985, 1986, and my dad said, well, my dad was kind of a fundamentalist. And so he said, "Whoa, was that pagan?" I said, "No, Dad, is kind of think of him like aliens, Dad." But meanwhile, you know, Thor's fighting to protect us from Surtur. Surtur's approaching. It was so cool at the time. So that was when I first noticed Walt Simonson's art. So good. But I actually, if I recall correctly, I do think I noticed him in retrospect on the X-Men Titans crossover, which I picked up.
I was about to mention that was tremendous.
Yeah. That may be one of my favorite standalone X-Men books just because of all the people involved and you had Simonson on art, Claremont on writing, but just this perfect cocktail of characters and story, and it stands alone, which is neat.
Yeah. And I want to say there was supposed to be a sequel to it that, Wolfman and Perez were
okay. That would have been great too,
which would have made sense, you know, to kind of pair off like that.
Right.
But it just never happened for reasons. These things.
JLA Avengers fell apart, and I think that the companies became a little more hostile with Shooter and.
Yeah, a lot of people lay that at Shooter's feet. He's had recollections of it, which I mean, everyone's always the hero of their own story. Right. but I will say if nothing else about Jim Shooter is he's always been consistent in his recollections of these things, true or not. He's never deviated in any retelling of,
these
bygone days. Yeah. So, I mean, he went into it extensively and he had a blog, a few years back that was actually kind of a must read for me on a daily basis because it was so interesting and just pulled the curtain back so much. He's at the point where he's got nothing to lose essentially. He's out of the industry. So he held nothing back and kind of gives no fucks. Not that he was a person who kind of ever did. And just really, really interesting, insightful stories and memories that he shared on that blog. And he talked about in great detail, this is what happened with JLA Avengers. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember those details now, but I'm sure it's still out there archived somewhere.
I have to assume it had to do a lot with Warner being a corporate company and Marvel being a relatively smaller company. And,
I think
so. You know, it just... Too many cooks in the kitchen too. Although I love Jerry Conway and George Perez, I saw their initial mock-ups and art that had been completed, and I think it was Amazing Heroes or a comic magazine like that. Mm-hmm. And so I was so excited for it at the time. But yeah, Perez is probably my all-time favorite, no matter what. Just goes. I go back to the first time I saw his art on New Teen Titans, and I reading him in Justice League and then discovering that he had done Avengers and Fantastic Four back in the day that wasn't as good. He even did some X-Men covers too that we'll look at too.
He did an X-Men annual too.
That's true. The Archon one or no?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I mean, it's not a high point of Claremont's writing or anything, but
it's of its time. Yeah, I it's neat to see how different he became when he went to DC though.
Right.
I don't know if it's just a different style of art or a different pool of inkers to work with, but I think he's awesome. And so anyway, any other writers besides say Claremont or Grunewald that you latched onto? Like, when did you start collecting and knowing that you were, you know, get a short box or a long box? When did you start saving these things and knowing that it was, like, your primary way of entertainment for a long time?
Oh, I would say around the time I was, like, 10 years old, when I had that was when I was regularly actually following series and going out of my way to fill gaps in my then growing collection. And that's when I sort of realized that comics were going to be a part of my life come hell or high water. And, you know, started investing in some long boxes and short boxes, probably short boxes at the time. But yeah, I mean, it was probably from that age on, like, you know, age 10, 12. And as far as kind of registering actual creators, I guess a little bit later, like early teens, I started picking up on, you know, you see the same names over and over again, of course, and you get accustomed to Fabian Nicieza, right? Who's writing 7 books a month for Marvel, like, no exaggeration. And at a certain point, you move from not just seeing these names, but actively recognizing, okay, if I pick up a comic from this writer, I have a reasonable degree of confidence that it's going to be pretty good.
Right. You see the quirks that each writer has, like a Peter David one will have a funny script, for instance, or.
And he's a prime example of one that I kind of gravitated to quickly, where I realized that what he was doing on X Factor was just the way he wrote his superheroes.
Right. So if you go back and read The Hulk, it had the same thing, or Spider-Man 2099, same idea.
Yeah. Wow. I forgot he did Spider-Man 2099, but yeah, sure did. That was a thing.
It existed. I know somebody that's his favorite iteration of Spider-Man. I'm like, really?
No kidding.
Really? Yeah. It's like Nick Duke. Nick Duke was raised on Ultimate Spider-Man. So that's his favorite.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to be where you come from and, you know, and if it's good, cool. But I mean, you can grow up and realize, oh, that Super Friends comic I read in the 70s, that may not have been the best representation of those characters.
Sure. So. Well, it's so funny, and I think this is, you know, it could prove to be a good segue or to dovetail into our second half here coming up. There's a saying that everyone's personal golden era or golden age of comics was whatever they were reading when they were 14 years old.
Oh, good point.
It's like that's when you're going to be at your most impressionable as a comics reader, probably. And that's what you're going to go back to over and over. It gets so ingrained in your mind that sort of regardless of or irrespective of quality, it just sort of taps into that, I don't know, just that primal thing that you're always going to want to revisit it. It stands out the most. There's that sentimentality to it. And even if it doesn't necessarily hold up, you can recognize that intellectually later on as an adult, but still appreciate that stuff for may almost appreciate how bad it is and how, you know, silly, and you think, gosh, how could I have liked this as a kid? But at the same time, you're always going to have that fondness for it.
Sure. Is there a comic like that for you specifically?
I don't know that there's any one in particular, but we've already mentioned the Grunewald caps.
Yeah, that's true, huh? Yeah.
I would acknowledge that is not a high point of superhero storytelling. But, I mean, it's goofy fun. I can read that stuff now today, and I'm not going to go, oh, I missed this, and this. Wow, this is so much better than I thought. I read it today and go, oh, my God, this is this is just ridiculous, but in the best best possible way. It doesn't embarrass me. It doesn't. It's not like looking at old cartoons and going, "This is just dreadful."
Right. Right. Do you have a recollection of Secret Wars 2, Tim?
No.
You're so lucky.
I know that the general beats of that story. I know about, of course, Spider-Man, quite famously instructing the Beyonder how to take a dump.
Emergency dump, if you will.
Yes. So
Disco Beyonder.
Disco Beyonder.
I remember Spider-Man cashing in his gold. He had a gold brick of some sort that came out of
right,
web like of Spider-Man.
I want to say, like,
I'm getting mine.
Yes, I remember the covers where I think it was where they like connecting images on two different books where I want to say, did they turn the World Trade Center into
yes,
gold?
Yes, that's what happened. Yeah. I think okay. Beyonder did that.
Yeah. Among other feats.
Oh, the Beyonder.
You're right, because that was all about him learning what it was like to be human, I think. That was the idea. So,
and that was 86, 87, it had to be around then.
Yeah, it would have been, I think, like 85, 86.
Yeah, well, Secret Wars was 84, 85, and then I think they waited mm-hmm. a couple months, maybe a year. And I think it was Milgram and Lealoa. Who the art team?
That sounds right.
I think so. But Byrne did the cover for the first one. I remember that being great.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was all these kind of little episodic stories, right? Where there wasn't – I mean, there was a central spine to the whole thing because it was, a 9-issue miniseries.
Yeah, it wasn't 12. It was 9. That's true. There's 9 mm-hmm. or 6. Anyway, where he eventually got – crazier and crazier and
yeah, and had to be stopped.
I think that might have been the end of the shooter thing for me was Secret Wars 2, or that you can see where Shooter took things just maybe a little bit too far editorially.
That was your bridge too far, huh?
Yeah.
Well, and that was a shooter trope of having this omnipotent being who just wants everyone to get along and to be understood. And I don't like to ascribe personal motivations to these things that we see on the page and actually read in the comics, but there's sort of an element of that running throughout anything that Shooter had his fingerprints, mm-hmm. Where it almost felt like he was personalizing a lot of this stuff. For better or worse. I mean, he did that with the Korvac saga.
Korvac, and that's kind of what gave him the impetus to become the editor-in-chief, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. I believe so.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that was basically the same idea as the Beyonder.
Yeah.
He did it with Molecule Man, who's kind of this ordinary guy, but with ungodly, crazy right. powers.
Was one of us. Yeah.
Did you bring the acoustic guitar?
I did. No, you know, it's been so long since we've done one of those. I forgot all about that. And I don't host too often anymore. No. So yeah, I didn't even think about that. I apologize for breaking in a song, but yeah, the shooter trope of the, what if you were suddenly, thrust into power as corporate executive and in charge right. of your entire line of things.
I'm not the megalomaniac people make me out to be, but damn it.
Just think, he was writing Legion of Superheroes at 13 years old, right?
Did yes, under I mean, Mort Weisinger.
Right.
Who was like the most legendary turd of a human being.
He was, and he was a weird writer who, you know, you just assume... you think of Superman as a fat guy or Jimmy Olsen as a turtle, giant turtle. That was Mort Weisinger right there.
Yes.
Batman of Zener R or whatever it was. That was Mort Weisinger supervision. So,
God. Yeah. So, I mean, what does that do to a kid, right? That's gotta,
what does that do to a person?
Yeah. Oh, but, I don't blame you if Secret Wars 2 was your bridge too far with Peter Marvel.
Technically, I think my 14-year-old comic, the comic that's kind of that I hold up, is actually New Mutants. Say the
I was about to say
Sienkiewicz and Claremont from the point Sienkiewicz came onto the book through maybe the late 20s, just every issue was something else. I would make a special trip out of my way to the local comic shop, which I don't remember what it was called, your favorite bookstore or something like that. And anyway, I would get just New Mutants for a long, long time. I wasn't an X-Men guy. I was a New Mutants guy. And Sienkiewicz's comics art was just something like nothing I'd ever seen before. And I recognized him as being very different, very multimedia. Where as an aspiring artist, and I'm terrible now, but back then I had aspirations to maybe do comics art one day.
Wow.
I could recognize how different and how unique Sienkiewicz was at the time. So maybe that New Mutants 21 Slumber Party, that's the one I can hold up and say that was the absolute thing that hooked me for life, even though I'd read comics before. But New Mutants 21 was like the one that just made me go, okay, comics can be more than just cool stories with kids, I don't know, fantasies.
Yeah, and that's a great point too, in that Sienkiewicz was like, his work on New Mutants, just as you said, was like nothing else coming out at the time, and it showed you the possibilities of this medium, where before it seemed like you were rather boxed in by the typical kind of 4-6 panel layout, mm-hmm. grid styles, you know, you worked within these rather narrow confines, and there's certainly some artists who are better than others, but it's still the same basic model that everyone's following. And then Sienkiewicz comes along, which didn't he cut his teeth on Moon Knight?
Yeah.
And at the time he was a pretty traditional,
he started artist. Out as a Neil Adams kind of clone.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden you started noticing these elements of photorealism, and he would do his art with razor blades and things like that. His blacks looked very different. Wow. It was just this something I'd never seen before in comics art. And apparently, you know, according to Tom Coker, well, lots of guys were doing that in pop art and in advertising, but Sienkiewicz brought it to comics. And so that's why mm-hmm. we all latched onto him. And then Mazzucchelli did a similar but different thing. About the same time or maybe a year or two later. So Sienkiewicz, though, as a kid, just spoke out to me. And then it got a little weird when he did the Legion stuff. That was where I could see him maybe pushing it just a little crazy with the hyper-realism, which as an older guy, I can see what he was doing for the story. But as a kid, it was like, oh, well, that's ugly now. I don't want to see that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and of course, sort of the what everyone – the first thing, at least I think of when I think Sienkiewicz and New Mutants, well, two stories, actually. You've got Legion and the Demon Bear saga.
Right. Was where he started. That was his first arc.
And those were just two stories that played to his strengths magnificently, because they're kind of psychedelic, doing this sort of dreamscape type of stuff, where he could just cut loose and didn't have to be confined to this is something that has to take place in a world that's recognizable. Mm-hmm.
Demon Bear, even today I could see that being adapted somewhere. I could see that on TV or something like that. It was so cool and so unique. In between, you had the Slumber Party arc where Slumber Party issue where Warlock shows up. And so mm-hmm. he got to stretch his art a little bit more techno-organically instead of this realism stuff and these dreamscapes he was doing with the Demon Bear. You know, he had this different thing. But go ahead.
No one else could draw Warlock like Sienkiewicz. Unfortunately, he was just a character that you feel like almost should have been retired or
when he left. Yeah.
Yeah. Because no one else could do.
Poor Lealoa. I know people who quit New Mutants and still hate Steve Lealoa for what he did after Sienkiewicz left. I'm like, well, that wasn't my New Mutants, but Yep. Then you go back, and Leoloa did some very cool things on his own style, but it was very in, it's like having to follow John Byrne on X-Men with Dave Cockrum again. And we'll talk,
I see what you're saying.
You know, yep. It's just like, well, I was reading it for this reason, and now this reason has become very, very mundane. And that's what my perception was anyway. And Leoloa, it just didn't feel right.
It didn't get tremendously better for a while. I mean, then you had Brett Blevins come in for a pretty long run.
Oh, Birdman. Wait, was that Birdman? Who was
Bird the Boy? Bird Brain, Bird Boy. Yeah.
Bird Brain.
Mm-hmm. Fall of the Mutants, right?
Boy.
So that's
weird that I associate that with Brett Blevins.
Yep. That's I don't know if that's where he started, but that was very early in his run. And I mean, he did get better over time, but that was another big tonal shift. Where I mean, you're miles away from Sienkiewicz, of course, by then. But he was I don't know. It became more, I want to say, cartoony in a sense.
It was very simplified. If you look at like Power Pack and other comics like that, that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
It's very, I don't know. The kids all looked very, very plain, and there was nothing special about it. It was perfunctory. It did its job to do the story, but New Mutants was kind of bland for years and years till Liefeld, unfortunately, if I recall. Right? Yeah. Is there anything notable about New Mutants as a book?
Well, what had happened was you had Claremont leave around like in the 40s or 50s of New Mutants. He had a good long run, but I can't remember where exactly he departed. And I believe the plan was for him to actually come back at some point, but he just got busy with other projects. So Louise Simonson came in. Who we talked about, she was already writing X-Factor and doing a fine job on that series. Problem with New Mutants is, from what I understand, there was an editorial push to kind of age them back down because they were, you know, they were the teenage X-Men book that they weren't supposed to be superheroes. They were supposed to be students, right?
Right.
And so it had drifted rather far from its original remit. And the argument could have been made that these characters didn't seem like kids anymore. But when you think about the experiences that they had had, I feel like they were probably being written appropriately for what they had been through.
Sure.
You know, we joked about Secret Wars too, but I mean, there were a few issues of New Mutants that intersected with that. One of which, the Beyonder kills all of them and resurrects them. So they've had this experience of dying and kind of that metaphysical concept that they can't really reconcile with anything because they're teenagers, right? I mean, what is, you're dead and now all of a sudden with the snap of a finger you've been brought back to life, and what does that mean? And it's, you know, they got a little bit of mileage out of that. But when Simonson came in as writer, she purposely was aging them back down to, you know, kind of early teenagers. And the stories that they were in reflected that.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of where the disconnect is for a lot of New Mutants readers and New Mutants fans. And you also lost a number of longtime characters that just one after the other started falling out of the book, basically. I think Magma was – no, Karma was the first to go, which, well, she had an
She had gone and come again, already.
Yeah, a few times. But she was eventually just gone for good.
Right.
Magma followed shortly thereafter, who was a pretty underdeveloped character anyway.
Not a lot to her. You know, you think of the Nova Roma, just you think of her as an aristocrat, but if you didn't know, you'd think she was just kind of basic blonde white girl. But she had
Doug got killed.
Yeah, which handicapped Warlock. Because Douglock was always more interesting for both of them to me.
Exactly.
Yeah. I liked Doug Ramsey a lot as a character.
Yeah, I mean he was one of those, just because he had non combat based powers doesn't mean you can't do anything with him. Really he should work in spite of that.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of treated as cannon fodder. But Louise Simonson said she did build in a backdoor to bring him back. She's gone on record as saying she's never killed any character without having a way to bring them back if need be. And sure enough, Doug did find his way back to the land of the living through some twists and turns later on. Were the 90s a thing.
Yeah. They were always trying to hook him up with older women, if I recall correctly. Well, he and Kitty were about the same age, right? They started out the same age?
Yeah, that's true. I guess they were, because Kitty was like the age of the New Mutants, but was on the X-Men.
Right. So Xavier is a jerk.
Mm-hmm. The famous Professor Xavier, he tried to demote her to the New Mutants, and she wasn't having it. But you forget that she was actually like the same age as them.
Right.
I think some of them were actually older than her, if memory serves. So, they kind of had, they never had a relationship proper, but there was a thing there. But I think the one you're probably thinking of is Psylocke.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so, Siege Perilous Psylocke.
Mm-hmm. Pre-Asian
right.
Ninja, whatever they did with Psylocke. Yeah, so she was ported over from the Captain Britain Marvel UK books, which was a thing that Claremont was pretty fond of doing. He liked he had worked on those characters in that series and liked to bring them into the mainstream. So, yeah, they had, like, a flirtation, which was odd and maybe a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's been a while since I read any of that stuff. True.
Did you ever project yourself onto any of those characters or see yourself in any of the X-Men characters specifically?
What a question. I mean, I don't want to talk about Cyclops very much on this show.
You're in a safe zone, Tim. I put aside all my feelings for, whoever was right or wrong.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, that is a character that I have identified with a lot on a personal level, but so much of this stuff is you decide on your favorite character for largely superficial reasons, I think. And then you ascribe aspects of your own character and your personality to them. And I think that's probably true of any of my favorite characters, is I just find ways to identify with them more after the fact. I don't know that I'm trying to think that there's any character that, from the jump I said, oh, that's me on the page right there.
Mm-hmm.
None really come to mind. Even growing up as a teenager myself and looking for reflections of my own experience, wasn't really finding it. And, there's an element to that there's probably a reason for. You haven't seen a lot of actual representation of LGBT mm-hmm. characters in comics and superhero comics until kind of the 21st century, I would say, when Comics Code fell by the wayside and and attitudes certainly shifted. But when I was growing up, you couldn't have an outright gay character or gay couple in mainstream superhero comics. You couldn't. Chris Claremont was a writer who pushed that as far as he could and certainly implied and got the message across with a lot of his characters. There's a queer subtext to many relationships between Claremont characters in particular, which could be an entirely different podcast, believe me.
But did you start shipping people?
No, I didn't really do the shipping thing. But I totally think Storm and Callisto were doing it.
Oh, nice.
Definitely. Storm and Yukio totally doing it. But I mean, I wasn't shipping them. It's just, that's how I read into
your perception. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it wasn't even like a question. That's how I read those things. Like, oh, he can't come out and say it, but obviously that's what's going on type of thing. Whereas, I mean, other people could have read those and been like, I think you're reading too much into this. Yeah. That was just sort of how it always came across to me, I guess.
Has X-Men always been a metaphor book for you?
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's the metaphor has always been there, and broadly speaking, mutants are a metaphor for anything, anyone that's ever been othered in some way, right? And there's strengths and weaknesses to that. You run the risk of overgeneralizing,
sure.
I think, and conflating things that you really shouldn't. Like, I mean, not to get all social justice warrior-y or anything, but I mean, the gay experience is not the black experience. You know what I mean? Like, there are, in terms of being oppressed minority groups, you can put a metaphorical spin on that, but it's a tightrope you walk, you know what I mean? And I think it's important to have not just metaphorical representation, especially in something like X-Men, but true, real representation. One-to-one.
Yeah, I think that we've learned that. You know, it's easier to be, you can be symbolic and all that, and that was fine, but I think kids really need to see themselves up there. They need to see that they're going to be okay no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's awesome that things have changed that way. My friend Larry, who's a little older, said, no, even in the 70s, I knew X-Men were about me as a queer American. I was like, okay, cool. All right, cool. Mm-hmm. If you say so. And as a kid, I didn't even see it, and I didn't understand it. If you look historically or when the time of the X-Men, when they came out, it was around the time of the Civil Rights Movement, but literally, they were all white kids. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so how does that work? But
and that's the thing. Like it helped. Don't get me wrong. That you could look at it and see, oh, this is a metaphor for they're different and I'm different. So therefore, we can come together and find some common ground here. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, if you're not seeing, here are actual queer characters, you're still only gonna be able to identify but so much.
Yeah.
Speaking just for myself, I'm not gonna try to speak for everyone in their experiences reading.
When were you aware that there were like creators who were gay out there?
I guess I always sort of knew.
You could assume so just on a representative sample, but I mean, as far as people who wrote from that experience and intentionally put representation out there.
I mean, I guess it probably took direct interviews with creators who would say things like, yeah, I'm a gay American, this is my experience, and therefore that's how I wrote this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
which, I mean, there aren't a whole lot of creators who are that sort of open and have gone on record and spoken to those things.
There aren't a lot. I can think of Phil Jimenez.
That's who I was thinking
of. When his Tempest miniseries came out, he did a really nice essay about how this was really a tribute to Neil Posner, who wrote the original Aquaman miniseries in 86 with Greg Hamilton. And, you know, what a pioneer he was. He was out. He was just deal with it. And he was Phil's real first boyfriend. And so it was interesting to see that.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
So I think that's the first time I saw it. It was really brave of Phil to do that. One of my favorite artists, by the way, even though he's obviously influenced by George Perez.
I was going to say, talk about George Perez. You can't look at Phil Jimenez art without, getting that glimmer of Perez in your eye at the same time. So, I try not to assume anything when it comes to creators and their, personal life or whatever, but when they do directly speak to, hey, this is what I've been through and I wanted to put that or make that clear in my writing, it does have a way of recontextualizing in your head, even something that you may have read already one way, and then having that color added to it is like, oh, okay. But I'm trying to think, within the X-Men universe in particular, Claremont certainly had his quirks, but he is a white heterosexual man.
So is John Byrne, who created North Star. He may have been the first out character I can recall in that universe.
Yeah, he was one that, again, it took several years before you could outright say, and they did it in a rather ham-fisted.
Yes.
But that was the early 90s. And I mean, that was progressive for the early 90s, even as kind of badly handled as it was. It was still an acknowledgement that you weren't getting prior to. The only problem is then he just became the token gay character after every story.
We define him this way. This is all he is, basically.
Yeah. Every story had to be about his gayness. So
did you ever get into Vertigo or books like that?
No, not really. Not growing up. That's been more of a recent thing, actually. I mean, it's one of those, I tell myself I should read more of types of things. But, I mean, I was so locked into just the Marvel zombie superhero world. But now, I mean, as someone in my 30s, I'm finding myself less interested in superhero comics only because at a certain point, you sort of feel like you've read every story that could be told with these characters.
Everything has to return to the status quo.
Yeah, it's all like very cyclical, comes back to center. You get that, and that's fine. It's a fine way of – it's that whole illusion of change type of thing. But after enough cycles, it just sort of gets old. So I've drifted away from – superheroes kind of in my grouchy, grumpy adulthood. Go ahead.
Are you buying anything currently?
Not any monthlies. I'm more of a trade waiter now. I'll hear about something and know that I should support a monthly book because you kind of have to. You're not going to get a trade if a series is canceled midway through publication. So you sort of feel almost a sense of obligation to pick something up monthly just to support the series and the creators and something that you like. But I just, you know, budgetary constraints being what they are, I can't do it. I've got to wait for the trade, or I've got to just, you know, do a digital type thing. I've gotten away from physical media as well. Not so much due to cost concerns there, but just the physical real estate that they take up.
Yeah, me too.
I've got a spare bedroom that is, I mean, nothing but comics piled up. And I go in there and it's just like, this doesn't make me feel good. Comics should make me feel good. And this just doesn't. This just makes me think junk stuff.
Have you tried drawer boxes? Have you seen those?
Yes, I have a couple of drawer boxes. I need to get some more because I've got so much just crap lying around that isn't in any box at all. But yeah, drawer boxes have been kind of a lifesaver.
Sure. They make a lot of sense, and you just, where you can go in and you can organize things. And I tell you what, I don't read as many comics as I used to, but I still find the zen in organizing my comics, and putting them in, you know, going through my last 6 months of books that are in bags that I picked up from the comic shop and then putting them in order and then integrating them into my collection. It's just like my happy place, you know?
I know exactly what you're talking about. I think people who don't have that experience are probably like, what? But it's just I think anyone, when you actually start organizing your life, you know, you get a sense of satisfaction out of that, and that's sort of the same idea. But with comics, you pick up a random issue here and there, even if it's just to file it away, and you might not ever take it out. For another 10 years, you still have that tangible association when you look at that physical copy, you know, you pick it up and you think of, oh, I remember where I was, where I read this or when I bought it, what was going on in my life. I have those kinds of associations, not with every single comic that I own, but for a good chunk of them, it just gets those memories flowing in a way that I don't know, other things in my life really don't. I don't know if it's nostalgia or just those pathways in the brain, you know, the way that we form connections with things, but
it is weird.
Comics hit that sweet spot for me, but organizing them
I don't know,
is something that
it with me, it's going back and finding things that I used to have and I don't have anymore, and so I'm going to find this collection, or I'm going to fill this gap in. It's almost a reconciling my past, trying to make my past make sense or hold on to more of it, even though I may never read this, you know, Bride of the Demon DC book again.
Exactly.
Are you on Marvel Unlimited at all?
I used to be. I'm not right now. That's not because I was dissatisfied with it or anything. I needed to take a break. Again, for financial reasons.
Sure.
But I love Marvel Unlimited. It's I think as close as we might get to a Netflix for comics. I want to see them add more and more stuff all the time.
Funny. There are things that aren't on there that make me angry that there aren't. On
yeah.
There. Like, why isn't Jessica weird. Jones on there, or Alias? Mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
I don't know. I mean, does it have to do with the fact that was a creator, was that a Max mature?
Because Punisher's on there. The Ennis Punisher is on there. So
I was going to say they've got other Max titles out there.
I'll have to talk to Ben Morrison, find out what exactly is the deal, and he'll just say, "Nope, thanks for promoting it, but I have no control. I don't know."
Sure,
I love it. I think it, once you find something you can tolerate reading it on, you know, once I got a big enough iPad that I could see it and mm-hmm. just, it felt close mm-hmm. enough, it's been great. I wish there was, I wish it was just everything. Everything that's more than 6 years old or 6 months old, it should be on there. But I right. know they've got to support their trade sales some way.
Yeah, I used to, I had a, my old laptop. It seems like laptops now are such shite for
disposable
because everything's like so it's like landscape orientation. You can get kind of like two pages to display on your screen pretty well, but it shrinks them down considerably. So something like an iPad Pro or I've even been looking at the Microsoft Surface.
Right. That's basically what the iPad is a ripoff of.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, mm-hmm. the Surface came first.
So stuff like that. I mean, I'm not averse at all to reading these things digitally. I know some people actually like having a physical comic in hand.
Tactile, and they got to smell it too.
Sure. Yeah, I guess I get the ink on their fingers. I don't know. Which there's something to be said for that, sure. But at the end of the day, when I can take all of this just shit that's taking up
right
all this room that I could compact down into something I can carry in a backpack, that's worth the trade-off.
Absolutely.
And it really doesn't diminish the reading experience for me. I mean, let's face it, how likely am I to go back there and start pulling out from my long boxes because I want to reread, Executioner's mm-hmm. Song from 1992, and I've got to go through probably four different long boxes uh-huh. in order to assemble all of those issues. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
Is it really worth it? I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen my collection. I have 43 drawer boxes.
Oh my God.
About half of them are in order, and then I gave up. And mm-hmm. with kids and with job and moving, we moved out to the suburbs, and now I everything's in the garage, which is terrible for your comics, but
sure.
It's the only place I have room, and so
yeah. What are you gonna do? Yeah.
Am I real? It's like I'm hedging my bets for retirement that I'll have a chance to go through them all one more time as I get mm-hmm. older and read them. But what was I thinking? why have I held on to all these?
I know. Yeah, and that's where I'm at too. I've got somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think at last count, like 23 long boxes, and that's not taking into account, again, the stuff that isn't bagged, boarded at all. It's just kind of sitting on a shelf loose, which could probably be another anywhere from 5 to 10 long boxes. I don't even know.
Right. Stuff you were getting in your weekly thing that you just said, I'll get to it eventually.
Yeah, exactly. And just got to the point where it was like, you know, I'm probably never going to read this crap. And that's sort of why that's part of the reason I had to give up the monthly fix was not only this is costing so much money, but I'm not even reading half of it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those, I'm telling myself I'm going to read it eventually. And yeah, I probably will, but life is only but so long.
Yeah. I know.
There are other priorities.
Our significant others. When, you know, my wife, I have to wonder what she thinks about me. Stuff that, am I really, why is he, because I had most of this before we even got married.
Sure.
But since we've become homeowners and everything, my trade collection and my, I don't know, more prestige versions of these same stories that I bought in single issues, that's grown, and you know, it's taken up a more of a footprint inside my actual house. So it's like I've prioritized the trades where I guess, you know, I still haven't found a good affordable collection of the Morrison X-Men or something like that. You know, there's an omnibuy, but I guess I think I was just, it's like the OCD we all have a little bit of. Uh-huh. If we break up our sets or sell them, something's going to be missing from us.
That's when you're going to start to miss it, is when you no longer have access to it. You can have access to it all day long and never go back there, never look for that random issue of anything, because I know it's there, it's just not worth the trouble. But once it's gone, that's when you start getting that like pull in your gut.
Yeah. Right.
You don't know what to do with that.
It's better to regret something you did than something you didn't do. I don't know.
I don't know the answer either.
Because you can look back and just, if I hadn't have sold that copy of Amazing Spider-Man 300 for $15 or whatever I did in 1992.
Sure.
So, well, cool. Yeah. Well, let's take a break, and when we come back, we will dive into one of Tim and my Holy Grails, which is the John Byrne era of Uncanny X-Men, along with writer Chris Claremont, starting at issue 108, the late 70s until the early 1980s, right here on Place to Be Network. And Place to Be, I'm drunk. I'm going to have to edit this out. So.
Or not.
Or not. So, yeah, emergency dump. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage wall pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
Place to Be Nation. We are back here with Tim Capel, and I hope you enjoyed the interview portion of the program. Today, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to look at one of the things Tim and I have in common. We're going to look at the Claremont Byrne era of Uncanny X-Men. This goes from, say, 1977, 1978 until the early 80s or so. Runs about 35 issues, and it's what most people would hold up as the apex or the best part of the X-Men run by Claremont, and many would say it's the reason comics maybe survived in the 80s or what got a lot of people into the comics in the late 70s, early 80s. So, Tim, do you recall when you started realizing that Claremont Byrne X-Men were a little different than, say, the first issues of X-Men you've gotten into?
Yes, and that is a great place to start off, actually, because we talked about how my formative years in reading comics was pretty much during the 90s when the X-Men was very much a going concern. It was, by then, it was the multimedia, ginormous franchise. Everywhere you looked, X-Men, everything, all the time. And certainly I was... Yeah. Right. Inescapable, right? So, reading the contemporary issues at the time, which, you know, the creators were like your Scott Lobdell and Andy Kubert on, Scott Lobdell and probably John Romita and later Joe Matarera on Uncanny X-Men. And you had Fabian Nicieza and Andy Kubert on Adjectiveless X-Men. And I was reading those issues and enjoying them for what they were worth. But as much as I am a 90s chromium age apologist, I was also at the same time reading a volume known as Marvel Essential. You remember those?
The black and white phone books?
The black and white phone book style trade paperbacks.
Looking at one right now.
Yeah, so collecting these huge chunks of issues from kind of the major franchises. I think they started with Fantastic Four, maybe Spider-Man, and did X-Men as well, starting with the all-new, all-different X-Men. So
giant-size X-Men number one, if you will.
Yeah, that's where that first volume of Essentials actually picked up. And I think later they went back and filled in, the X-Men from the Silver Age.
Right. They call that something else, but it is – they did a three-volume set of those too.
Yeah, it's called it something else. So at first I was a little bit put off just by the fact that it was black and white art. I don't know. When you're 15 years old and you're reading full color, often full bleed comics, especially picturing what the coloring was like in books that were coming out circa 1997, and then you know you're going to trade down to you've got just pencils and ink, essentially, no pun intended. That was lame, but
this came out in 96, if I recall correctly, or if I've looked it up right. So,
okay,
couldn't have been before then. Right.
Yep. It was around the time it came out that I picked it up. I don't think it was. I mean, it took me a little while to talk myself into, yeah, I can still handle non-colored art if the story is there and if this is really everything that it's made out to be, because certainly I had heard about, well, if you've read X-Men, you haven't really read X-Men unless you've read Claremont Byrne X-Men. So I was like, okay, let's do this. And I was not disappointed. It was one of those things where, one of those very rare things in life where it actually lived up to the hype. What I was reading in those, and they did a few volumes of Essentials. I think it was the second volume that really had the majority and the entirety of the Claremont Burn stuff.
Almost everything of Volume 2 is Claremont Burn. I think they have maybe 144 and a couple annuals that are not.
Yeah.
But yeah. One has a little bit, but it's mostly Cockrum. But 2 is almost entirely Claremont Burn. And it's nice that we have this, because I have both of these. And it's primarily... It's easier for me to pull these out than it is to get into my collection and find the whole run, which I have somewhere, but I, you know.
Wow. No doubt. So, having that experience of reading the monthly X-Men comics that are coming out in 1996 and 1997, and then reading the classic stuff at the same time, it was like, there was just no comparison. You know what I mean? And I don't know if I sound elitist or like a snob or whatever, but I was like, oh, okay, I get it. This is why X-Men became the thing that it did. You really do see how it's the template for what X-Men would turn into. I very quickly got past my reservations about just the black and white art. I did for years and years want to experience them in full color, and just because of the price of back issues, I was like, gosh, I don't know if I'll ever really be able to do this.
Right.
And then it dawned on me, oh, there was this little reprint series called X-Men Classic.
Yep.
Uh-huh. And those were super cheap. I mean, like...
Yeah, they're back issue 50-cent bins.
Exactly. So I was like, why did it take me so long to remember that? Because I knew that, you know, I think the series might have still been running, actually. It would have been well into... You know, the Claremont, Smith, or Romita years.
I believe
by
so.
Then.
Yeah, I think they got all the way up to about 200 or so, and then they stopped making us.
Yeah. So I knew that was a thing, and I was like, "Why don't I just track down those back issues?" And I did, and it was even better. And here we are.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I experienced those. And so
plus,
it was
the first year or so had really good. What do you call it? Co-features or after stories by John Bolton.
Mm-hmm. They had backup Claremont. Strips mm-hmm. because the comics themselves, the reprints, were only like 17 pages or so.
Very short. And you go back in the essentials and they're very quick reads because they're only 15, 17 pages.
Exactly. So they could fill those out with the backup strips that gave you some more. It just sort of filled in the margins around those stories, and they're really, you know, character centric, character focused type, like 8-page quickie, but some of them were really good.
Mm-hmm. I remember they've done a couple trade collections, or at least one trade collection of these. So
yeah,
it's pretty funny that they took these B stories, these backstories that were in a reprint series, and they're good enough to get a trade. So that's pretty awesome.
And then reprinted those, right? Yeah.
So
crazy. So how did you encounter this run?
I had heard about it just in chatter or in letter columns or whatever in the early 80s or so. And by the time I was reading X-Men and New Mutants, it was Paul Smith in X-Men era. So mm-hmm. I hadn't had a chance to see the Burn, but I knew Burn from other things. I knew Burn from Fantastic Four, off issues of Avengers, and especially Superman and Legends when he came to DC. So eventually I'll check this out. And so I started just in the mid-late 80s starting to get the back issues where they were sometimes $10 to $12 a pop, which was a lot of money.
Yeah. I was going to say, were those expensive even back then?
Relative to the time they were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
I'm thinking of one issue in particular that I'm wondering how you... were able to get your hands on if you did.
I didn't get, I have everything from about 112 on. So I didn't get Giant Size or X-Men 95, which are Cockrum anyway. But as far as I had reprints of those, they would put out Giant Size X-Men in different reprint formats a lot.
Yeah.
So I had at least read that. I think I read that actually in a little fireside paperback book that I got at a Fred Meyer store back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
That was also black and white. So I knew about the all new, all different X-Men. But just getting into the Byrne series, you see, oh my gosh, the art is so good and it's so clean. And
that's the word that comes to mind for me too. That when I think of that early Byrne art, it's clean. And I mean, as good as a traditional superhero artist as Cockrum was, and don't get me wrong, I think he did tremendous work on X-Men. I'm a big fan of that Cockrum stuff, and I don't know that we would have gotten as far as we did in mm-hmm. that series had it not been for the groundwork that Claremont and Cockrum laid. The only problem was Cockrum could not keep to a monthly schedule, so no matter how well the book was doing, it was pretty much limited to being a bi-monthly series.
Right. It was bi-monthly until, I think, 102 or so?
Yeah, I actually took a note of that earlier today. It was... So... I think 113 is when it went to being monthly again. So early into the Byrne run. Byrne had done a few... Byrne came in at 108 and got a few issues under his belt, I guess, before they were confident enough to say, let's give this a go monthly again. Mm-hmm. And certainly sales had to play a part in that because it was sort of – it was not – the blockbuster runaway success that people think of X-Men being. I don't know that it ever quite became that under Byrne. I think it took, you know, that quiet buzz that was building, but actual sales were slow and sort of trailed mm-hmm. buzz back then, since you had lack of the internet and the immediacy of these things. So it steadily built momentum, and I think it wasn't until Byrne was actually off the book and Smith came on that X-Men kind of exploded up the sales charts, and there was no looking back. Yeah. But, I mean, it was a steady climber and critically acclaimed, got, you know, again, that it factor that it had never had before. So that, I mean, certainly contributed to it going monthly, but man, Byrne was a consistent artist. I mean, I was looking at his resume earlier today, and do you realize he was penciling three monthly team books from like mid-1979 through the end of the year. So for a 6-month period, he was doing X-Men. He was doing Fantastic Four. This is before he actually took over fully.
Writing,
Fantastic
too,
Four.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was penciling it and doing Avengers. Three fucking team books. I mean, that was unbelievable to me. I was like, this can't be right. There's just no way.
Yeah.
But he was...
unprecedented. Sure. And I can't leave out Terry Austin, too. If you look mm-hmm. at compare Byrne... inking himself, say, on books like Fantastic Four versus when Terry Austin would ink him on X-Men. I'd prefer the Austin, honestly, which is weird because if I look at somebody like George Perez, when he inks himself, it's my favorite thing in the world, but it's so mm-hmm. rare because it takes up so much more time. But Byrne, I actually prefer with different inkers. Joe Sinnott inked some of his Avengers stuff, and it looks even better to me. It's just, it's kind of this classic Marvel style. Versus just it's less Byrne-y for whatever reason.
Yeah, no, I feel you there. I definitely can't leave Terry Austin out of the equation either when I think of Byrne as an artist on X-Men. You know, I'm kind of hot and cold with some of Byrne's other mm-hmm. stuff just artistically, but I mean, when he was paired with Austin on X-Men, that was, you want to talk about firing on all cylinders. Not to mention, something that never gets talked about is just the lettering. Tom
Orkazowski.
Yep. I think one between the two of us, we might have gotten
again,
that,
very, very consistent. And you saw mm-hmm. it and you knew it was X-Men.
It, yeah, super distinctive and just didn't look like any other book on the stand. And that's not something I could appreciate until later, when I was reading other kind of like Bronze Age Marvel series just in back issue form and going, you know, these are fine. But when I compare it to X-Men, it's like everything about X-Men compared to basically every other book Marvel was putting out, it just made them look bush league, even if they were well written and perfectly fine. When you compare it to X-Men, it's just like, this feels like a prestige series and it's just a monthly book.
And it's funny, Orkazowski didn't even take over till, I think, let's see, first one I see him on is 116. He might have been a little earlier than that, but still, so he was maybe the later part of it. Let's look at the team. Who was on the X-Men at that point? 108 was, you had Cyclops. Yeah. You had basically the giant-sized team. Mm-hmm. So all the international heroes except for Thunderbird and Sunfire.
So, yeah, they had killed Thunderbird by then. Sunfire dipped out, like, first real issue of the new team. Mm-hmm. And they had shipped off all of the original X-Men minus Cyclops, who stuck around. Yeah, and Jean, Jean wasn't – she wasn't supposed to be a member of the team, but she kept getting dragged back into stuff. And 108 was actually – again, Byrne's first issue, that was the conclusion of the original Phoenix Saga.
Right, so, Starjammers, and you had all these – you had the Stargate that they took to space.
Yes, the Imperial Guard.
Right.
Mm-hmm, who were riffs on all the Legion characters.
Right. Started by Cockrum, so
– yeah.
Very, very consistent. But Byrne, awesome job with him. I mean, it's, that 108 is – you just go AB with 107 and you see what a difference in the art, in the storytelling.
Exactly.
The expressions of the characters.
And what a credit to him to come in at the tail end of this story that's been going. I mean, that story felt like it must have felt like it just took ages to
with
finish.
With the bi-monthly thing.
Bi-monthly, and it's something like 8 issues anyway. Yeah. So it was just forever going on. And Byrne comes in at the tail end of it and has to wrap this thing up. And he does a pretty bang-up job of it.
Are you a fan of Starjammers in general? Or
not really. Not as such.
It mesh with X-Men to me. I mean, it's nice for the backstory for Summer, for Cyclops, but that's about it for me.
Yeah, I just – that's one of those things that Claremont would throw out there that just felt very – at odds with kind of the central premise of X-Men, which X-Men has a lot of that stuff. I mean, there's Starjammers, Shi'ar, all the space, oddities type things. And I mean, even the Phoenix and Dark Phoenix stuff doesn't play into the central themes of X-Men much. You could stretch it to work, I guess, but ultimately it's a very kind of character centric story that, I mean, you could do with a lot of different superhero concepts.
Sure, yeah. Fantastic Four, Avengers, much more likely to go into space historically.
And, I mean, X-Men just has a lot of stuff. You look at the Savage Land. I mean, what does that have to do with anything? Other than, I mean, it's cool, but it's not really – and there's nothing inherently X-Men-y about it. So, but yeah, not really a fan as such of kind of the spacefaring and especially the Starjammers. A little goes a long way with that material.
Yeah, they kept bringing them back and bringing them back. I mean, we've had at least 4 in the classic Claremont era. I think there were 4 different instances where the X-Men and Starjammers interacted, where there was a space story or a moon story or something. And it's always a non sequitur to me. After that first Byrne issue, they're back on Earth, and we get some story on Wolverine where Guardian, or what do we call him?
Agent, Weapon Alpha.
Weapon Alpha, that's right. James Hudson from Alpha Flight comes and tries to retrieve him for the Canadian government, because we saw Wolverine leave Weapon Alpha, or what do we call it? Department H?
Yes. So
in Giant Science.
This is before there's really an Alpha Flight, although I think he does.
He does mention, I'm coming back with Alpha Flight. He does mention
him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was just a one-and-done story, but I did appreciate it for just filling in kind of that dangler of, yeah, Wolverine did go AWOL, and someone should probably care that he just essentially walked off the job.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that would be a fairly big deal in Marvel Universe Canadian government circles, yeah, where
he's only
for whatever reason,
100 miles south of the Canadian border.
Yeah.
In Westchester. So it's also the start to me of the classic X-Men have a day off story. You know, people are going to a picnic, or there's a baseball game, or something like that, where we don't see the school, but we do see the team with their masks off and insisting on calling each other by their, not their code names, but their personal names.
Right. Yeah. I think Nightcrawler like goes on a date with,
it's a double date
character.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Moira. Double date. He and Colossus, right?
Yeah.
With a pair of ladies, one of whom would become somewhat more important later down the line. Banshee and Moira MacTaggert, they like have a picnic or something,
with,
right?
With Storm and Colossus. So,
mm-hmm.
And Moira's Charles's ex, basically.
Right. So they had a history together, and she was introduced as basically the housekeeper early in the Claremont Cochran run, but this is where we start to learn there's a little bit more to her. So yeah, good downtime issue. Does have the requisite fight scene, which is all well and good. Jean is going through her stuff. The fashion is pretty incredible because this is still, what, 1978,
yeah,
probably?
Yeah, 78
now. And that's something else that I think changed under Byrne. Like, he seemed more aware of and wanting to put a then-modern spin,
sure,
on his characters. Not that Cochran didn't do that, but It seemed like Byrne was maybe actually paying attention to contemporary fashions and the look of the era.
Yeah, and I mean, as contemporary as it looks now, it still looks and holds up very well. But if you look at when they're out of costume, things are very, very different.
Exactly.
Everything's plaid or fabric, you know. Their hairstyles are a little bit longer than you normally would see in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
You got a fill-in issue in 110 and then in 111. All of a sudden, you get plopped into the middle of a storyline where Beast is at a carnival and he sees the X-Men as circus freaks, basically. And it looks like it's Arcade, but it's not Arcade, in who we learn about later. But it's actually a character called Mesmero. Do you know much about that guy?
Yeah, I remember he was kind of a holdover from, again, the Silver Age,
right,
the original Five era.
Yeah.
He didn't really make a splash back then, but a lot of the stuff with Claremont, starting with Claremont and Cochran, was them riffing on the probably more the Roy Thomas, Neil Adams,
right? The Havoc Polaris era.
Uh huh. Exactly. Yeah. So this is sort of a callback to that a little bit with Mesmero. Not that I don't think Neil Adams was around for that, but certainly Roy Thomas would have been. And I like this because of the great reveal at the end, right? Which,
right,
again, is riffing on sort of a what would become, wasn't yet, but would turn into a X-Men cliche
down the road. Right. You have a smaller story, but it ends up as a gateway to the big bad showing himself. And when this was still a big deal, you know, he would only come out every 3 or 4 years as opposed to now where every year,
yeah,
the X-Men's main adversary, Magneto, shows,
exactly,
up. So that he turns out to be behind the whole thing, and we get to see just this amazing John Byrne art on Magneto.
Yeah, that awesome, one of the many, many awesome last page Magneto reveals. And I like that this brought Beast back into the X-Men fold as well. From what I understand, unlike Chris Claremont, John Byrne was a guy who really was an X-Men super fan, like from the very first issue of that series. He wasn't overly fond of the all new, all different take on them. He was trying to bring back as many of the classic original characters as he could. So he had Cyclops already. Jean was back on the team proper now that she was in her Phoenix identity, which for a while they didn't really, of course, they didn't make a distinction between these are actually separate characters.
Right. It's just, no, that was retconned, basically.
That was, yeah, a big retcon. This, as far as we knew, was just Jean leveling up.
Right. But even now, you don't see a lot of Phoenix on Earth as much. And she was very prominent during the Starjammer saga. But now with this next storyline, I mean, she's there, but she doesn't crank things up like she does a little bit later in the run.
Yeah, and that's the thing. People think that, okay, the Phoenix saga happened and Jean got these incredible powers and then she went evil. Like, they forget about that big chunk of issues where she's just a member of the team.
Yeah. It's a slow burn, very slow burn. Sorry.
We keep doing it to each other. But I mean, yeah, she was certainly very powerful and growing in power, but basically it was just, let's give her a boost because the Marvel Girl thing is kind of lame. So, you know, let's just reinvent this character. And I think that was the only motive that probably Claremont had initially in doing that. So,
well, and she anyway, seems pure Cockrum in her design. You know, she's very out of the Legion of Superheroes. So I could see the collaboration there, but it's nice that they were able to just like take their time with it. And that's the thing about Claremont. He'd put a line here or a line there that would take years to pay off.
Yeah. And even he would forget about them sometimes. Have to be reminded by his editors. Hey, you know, you never did anything with this. But
looks
now
like
we've got,
they went monthly in 112 with that Magneto, kind of like the climax of the Magneto story.
Okay. Yeah. I was off by one issue then.
Yeah,
all right.
Not bad.
I'm not good with issue numbers except for stuff like this. X-Men, I can kind of cheat. I can cheat fake my way through it, with actual issue numbers. But, anyway, we've got Beast now coming back in, and that's another thing. Like, Beast was a pretty surprisingly popular character, it seemed like, in the 70s, where Englehart had done created the new...
Right, the secondary mutation where he was blue.
Yep. And so he had that little run in the series, what was it called?
Amazing Adventures or something like that.
Yes, that sounds exactly right. So he had the run there, and then he joined the Avengers.
And then Champions. Was he on Champions or no?
He was not on Champions,
okay.
But
Angel
he
and
would
Iceman.
Later join Defenders.
Defenders, that's what it is. Plus the, who can forget the Beauty and the Beast miniseries in the mid-80s.
Oh, my God, with Dazzler, right?
Dazzler. I don't know who wrote it, but I think it was Don Perlin did the art, but it had some Kevich covers, so that's why I remember.
Yeah, it was somebody like, I want to say, like, Joe Duffy or somebody.
You know, it
like
might have
that.
Been DeMatteis, too.
I think it was Annacenti who wrote that.
Who was an X-Men editor. That's how we know.
Yeah, her. She was an which, so that kind of would have made sense. But anyway... Beast, surprisingly popular and in-demand character, because he was actually a member of the Avengers at this point. And I guess, you know, Byrne just wanted him for X-Men, so they managed to work it out because he sticks around for quite a bit here.
Did you have trouble as a kid? Well, you probably passed this, but I was a real young kid. So the first couple times I saw Beast and Nightcrawler together, I would get confused when there was a headshot. They were both blue and dark and had, especially Giant Size, I think, because I had a black and white reprint of Giant Size, so I didn't see much of a difference between them. It took a lot of, you know, I was 8, 9, 10 years old.
Huh. It's so funny that we both read these in
black and white formats,
you know? No, I mean, I didn't have that problem, only because I was already familiar with all the characters here. From, you know, again, my contemporary reading habits. So I never had that trouble. And I never had issues following, the story and the black and white, essentials volumes that I was reading. But yeah, it's funny. I can see how you can make that mistake, because how many blue bestial looking mutants can there be?
Furry.
Turns out quite a lot.
with elf ears. Yeah. Anna Senti did write Beauty and the Beast.
You know, okay.
Crazy.
Gosh. Wow. So, all right. So we're now talking about this, Magneto reveal. This turns into a pretty big, this is like Byrne's first proper contribution as a storyteller. I think 113 or 114 is where he's credited as co-plotter for the first time. Uh-huh. And I have to say, this is my very favorite X-Men versus Magneto story. I wouldn't say it's my favorite Magneto story necessarily, but just as a good beat 'em up X-Men versus their arch enemy story, this is hands down my favorite one. It's so great because you see, this is still like, we're steeped in Silver Age cackling villain Magneto, where he's just a complete motherfucker. I mean, he is an asshole through and through with no redeeming qualities. That is not going to come in until a little bit later. But under Claremont, he's at least written well, even if he's still not an especially layered character. And what you have, and by the way, this is all taking place in a secret lair. They're in a volcanic base,
yes,
that I guess Magneto has set up.
Yeah, it's conveniently very dark, too. So there's not a lot of backgrounds to any of these panels.
Sure, which here again, with Byrne penciling two other books at the same time, like, maybe, maybe that can be excused. Doesn't seem like the most practical location for a supervillain secret lair, but I don't know. Magneto gonna Magneto, right?
Yeah. So. Secret villain, super villain, gotta have a lair. Gotta have a evil place. And so X-Men band together and Phoenix kind of shoots her whole load and they take him out, knock him out. He escapes, but they end up in the Savage Land.
Yeah, they end up getting separated. And I have to give a call out to one panel in particular in this storyline where the X-Men are rallying now, right? First, Magneto has whipped their asses because they tried to each individually attack him, and they failed miserably, which the story makes a good point of saying, you have to pull together and actually act like a team, and that's the only way they're able to finally beat him. This is the first time we've seen the all-new, all-different X-Men work together as a real team. So when they make their big comeback, there's this great panel where it's like four energy blasts that all hit Magneto at the same time, and they form the images. It forms an X with the, you know, the energy blasts, and Magneto is right in the center of it, and it's one of those things that it might not register until you have that, oh, okay, that aha moment of looking at it. But that's something that just stands out as really cool and very, very John Byrne.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Do you remember the sound effect?
Some of them. I know that there was a Zark in there.
This one is
there
a Shizkow.
Shizkow. Very
so,
good.
So you have the four different energy beams, right? You have the Cyclops, Phoenix, Storm, and let's see, who is the other one?
Probably Banshee.
Banshee, there you go. The Sonic Scream, you see the little circles. And then, so you have the X, and they're all going through Magneto's body, but on each side you have Shizkow.
And very good.
He's
very
got his good. Robot maid too, don't forget.
Yes, his robot maid Nanny, who I think gets hit in the crossfire, right? She goes flying.
Oh, Nanny, we barely knew ye.
Yeah, yeah. And they bring her back for the trial of Gambit, the classic swan song of Scott Waddell in 1997. So I was probably reading that.
Boy, I did not know that.
Yeah, I think I was probably reading that story at the same time I was reading this and going, that stupid fucking robot was around back then. So, yeah, fun fact. This story ends with Magneto being defeated and much, again, another Chris Claremont trope. They have now snatched defeat from the jaws of victory because although they've won the battle, they're kind of losing the war. This volcanic base is now collapsing. They're all going to die. They end up getting separated where Beast and Phoenix are like on one side and they're in, I want to say Antarctica.
Yeah. Snow. He's walking with her in the snow and then everybody mm-hmm. else, where could they be? Oh, they must be dead. Beast right. thinks they're dead.
Each side thinks the other is dead. And the other faction consisting of most of the actual members of the team, they make their way to the Savage Land, which we mentioned earlier, because that is like a secret hidden world nestled within Antarctica, right?
Right. So. Tropical paradise where there's dinosaurs and you have Marvel's own Tarzan character, Kazar.
Kazar,
yeah. Yeah. And
Zabu, his saber-toothed tiger.
Right. But meanwhile, you have mutant dinosaur character Sauron is down there. I mean, this calls back to the Roy Thomas era of X-Men, too.
Once again, yes, exactly. It's an okay story. I think what I think of and what stands out in my mind is there's a scene where, you know, the X-Men are looking pretty rough. They're kind of haggard. They haven't showered in a few days, of course, because they're in this tropical wonderland. It must be pretty musty there, kind of humid. And Cyclops in particular happens to catch his reflection like in a pond, and he's like all disheveled and unshaven, and he's like almost got a beard going on, and he realizes that, you know, I kind of resemble a space pirate Corsair with this beard I'm sporting. It's sort of a ridiculous scene.
Yeah, he's got a headband. Because, it's like, wow, yeah, that's pretty heavy-handed.
He's looking like, gosh, we look an awful lot alike. And this is
called
before
him Captain Summers, right? They've called Corsair that before at this point.
Well, only Phoenix and Storm actually know at this point.
And the readers.
And the readers, yes, that he is Scott's father. No one else does, including Scott. That will come a little bit later, but this is the first time where I guess he starts to wonder only because he bears a vague resemblance to him and this reflection in the water because he has a headband on and a little bit of facial scruff. So this is Bronze Age storytelling.
Is he wearing his Ruby Quartz goggles at this point?
I think, yeah, he's just got his shades on, not his actual visor.
Not his visor. Yeah, I think there's an iconic two-page spread with Perez that Byrne drew with everybody against Sauron, where he's got Storm held hostage.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good, where you see Wolverine slashing at him. I think that's a pretty big deal in the art of the story. But I don't remember a whole lot about this story otherwise.
This might have been where Wolverine's healing factor was actually introduced as well. Because he gets his arm chomped on by a dinosaur. And he pops his claws and kills the thing, and Storm is like, oh my god, your arm, thinking he's gravely injured, and he makes some comment to the effect of, you know, well, I heal really quick. And that's sort of the final word on it. And I mean, Wolverine had been taking a beating in like every story up to this point. I mean, it sort of became a running gag in the Cockrum stories where he was like the first guy taken out in every fight. In the Phoenix Saga, he literally gets punched into orbit and doesn't come back around until the conclusion of that. So there were enough hints that there was something more to this guy going on, but this is where it's more explicitly referenced. Well, hey, I heal quick, and
plus,
that's not.
This is a team of mutants, right? So how is our metal claws anything that would be a mutant power? So
yes,
at some
yes.
point they have to reconcile why is he an actual mutant? What makes him different?
Yeah, they had already confirmed that his claws, at first it was suggested that his claws were just part of his costume, but it was established, I think, in that Sentinel story, like in the late 96, 97, thereabouts, that his claws actually popped out of his
right.
hands. But like you said, why would that be a mutant power to have metal claws? So getting a little bit more, Wolverine's getting a little bit more fleshed out.
And, you know, you see Byrne, that's his avatar. That's his character that he relates to. He's Canadian. So he, mm-hmm. you know, Wolverine without Byrne would not be the character that we know and love.
Yeah. Yeah. He took a shine to the character. Weren't any other like prominent Canadian superheroes. So Byrne kind of adopted Wolverine. Seemed like Claremont didn't have a ton of interest in the character. I've even heard that he was contemplating just writing him out altogether, and Byrne was like, over my dead body.
Yeah.
So,
and it's a good thing. I mean, he stuck with him, and you'll see the evolution of that character continue as we look through the series. But Savage Land ties up. They go against Garrok, I believe is the character. Is that his name?
Yes. Well, according to the animated series, Garrok. But who knows?
What's the deal with that dude? I don't know a whole lot about him. I associate him with a later X-Men annual or a story
I was about to say.
In the 90s.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's pretty much the extent of the deal with that dude. He turns up in this story and then comes back in that that annual crossover, which was, was it Evolutionary War?
Yeah, I think so, with the High Evolutionary.
Or that might have been after they did the line-wide annual crossovers and were doing more just within series of interconnected titles, annual crossovers. But anyway, neither here nor there, not a major character by any stretch of the imagination. So that wraps up this this Savage Land arc. And next we head to, is it Japan?
Well, it's the Psy War first, which is, think, a story with Jean and Misty Knight, if I recall correctly, talking about, well, what's next? Because everybody believes the X-Men are dead, and Charles is there. And so the Charles has this flashback story about him against the Shadow King. Meanwhile,
so it's a flashback,
the X-Men hitch a ride on a Japanese freighter back to Japan, and it's, I think, Sunfire is involved somehow. But I know this story a little bit just because it was the second half of that paperback I got that had Giant Size 94 or Giant Size X-Men number 1 in it, had this story also in its collection, which is it's just kind of random. I remember Little Girl Storm pops up in the flashback.
Oh, yeah, in Psy War, she sure does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, so it's Professor X, his battle with the Shadow King on the astral plane. Yeah, they're just seated opposite each other in like a bar in Cairo.
Right.
Storm is a thief at that point, I believe, under the thrall of Shadow King, or she was just working for him.
Yeah, I think so.
It's just a little cameo that she has as a child.
And each they have this battle against each other in the astral plane, and everybody they each try to one up each other with different kinds of armors, different strategies, and eventually Charles just realizes he's holding himself back, and he unleashes his raw power and gets out of there.
Mm-hmm. And Shadow King, in his human form, what was his name? Amal Farouk.
Yeah, he had there's the panel of him just falling down onto the table.
Yeah. Just slumps down, right? That's what I'm picturing. But the Shadow King would actually persist as a psychic entity after that.
You see the New Mutants next, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Karma.
Yep. Oh my God! You remember what he did to Karma?
Yeah, he made her fat.
He did. Oh my goodness! That was so cruel. That was just so cruel. Like, he only did it because, you know, he could, basically.
We made her interesting. And we gave her an angle, so to speak. Charles makes the decision to go off to space with Lilandra, his alien Shi'ar girlfriend.
Right. She had been back on Earth since the ending of the original Phoenix Saga.
Yeah.
While they're working out the bureaucratic process of her taking over the Empire. So I guess they've gotten that, the red tape, sorted out there. So they make off into space. It's worth noting, the friendship between Jean and Misty Knight here.
Yes.
They were actually roommates, shared an apartment together. And you may be wondering why Misty Knight is appearing in X-Men comics.
Well, didn't Byrne and Claremont write Power Man and Iron Fist?
Yes. So that was actually Claremont and Byrne's first creative collaboration. It was on the Iron Fist series, which only lasted like 14, 15 issues. And that's where, you know,
what
Claremont
iconic,
has a – do what?
What iconic villain showed up there first?
Well, yeah, you had Sabretooth introduced in that series in a very different version.
Yeah.
And the final issue of Iron Fist was sort of a trial run for Byrne's X-Men. All of the X-Men actually guest star in it. And it honestly feels like an issue of X-Men that Iron Fist is guest starring in. He's like the guest star of his own series, it feels like, if you've ever read that last issue.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I wonder if it's on Marvel Unlimited.
It's worth checking out. It has, oh my gosh, it has Wolverine appearing in his, all right, do you remember when he stole the costume of one of the members of the Imperial Guard
in the
Phoenix story?
It's kind of like a prototype of his brown costume.
Exactly. So he's actually wearing that in this Iron Fist issue because Dave Cockrum wanted to make that his new permanent outfit.
Right.
But of course Cockrum was out by then and Byrne was just not having it. And he was like, there's no way he's keeping this dumb costume.
Yeah, it looks like Timberwolf, but like a Native American Timberwolf or something.
Vaguely.
Major character.
Yep. So Byrne did have the responsibility, I guess, of drawing him in that costume in this one random issue of Iron Fist, and then it was never seen again. So that was kind of an interesting bit of trivia I found when I was reading over this stuff. But, you know, Claremont has a way of – he likes to work in and weave characters in and out of the different series that he works on. And that's what we see here with Misty Knight popping up in X-Men. We'll see a lot more of that kind of as this run progresses. But, yeah, worth noting that Misty and Jean are roommates. So they're living in the city and – there's probably a sitcom that could be made.
You could, yeah.
But that would be quite something.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, if you really want to go there, have you been watching How to Get Away with Murder?
I have not. No.
Okay. Well, Famke Janssen's on that show, so you can imagine her, and she ends up having a relationship with a woman with Viola Davis.
So, very good.
There you go. There's your show right there. The X-Men have been separated from The rest of the group, everybody thinks they're dead. They end up on a freighter, and they end up in Japan in issue 119, 118. Yeah, so yeah.
They battle Moses Magnum.
No, not yet. Not yet, I don't think. Not yet. I think this is Sunfire first. They resume with Sunfire. Maybe Moses shows up at the end.
Yeah, this was just like a little two-parter, wasn't it?
I think so. Guest art or guest inker, not Terry Austin, but somebody named Rick Villamonte, who I don't know who that is. So it's very dark.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, the inks aren't as detailed. The story is not as sharp as the burn art you're used to. But it's
I remember this one looking different. Yeah, I don't know that I paid enough attention to notice Terry Austin wasn't inking. But yeah, I do recall this one looking rather different.
They have their initial battle with Sunfire, and then they work their things out. But then they're attacked by a different force that ends up being Moses Magnum. So
okay, yeah. And the Mandroids, right?
That's who they're... Yeah, like anti-Avenger. Yep.
Yeah, right.
Kind of sentinel-y, but with tentacles on their shoulders.
Right, yeah.
Also, Logan Wolverine meets Mariko here.
Yes. So this is more fleshing out of Wolverine, right, where we learn that he knows Japanese. He can both read and speak Japanese, and... Everyone is so shocked by that. And Nightcrawler, why didn't you tell us you could speak Japanese? And Wolverine's very terse answer, well, you never asked. So we're getting a little bit more depth to his character. And he now has a romantic interest beyond kind of creepily pursuing Jean Grey.
Right. There's,
which
goes back to maybe 100 where he tore a skirt.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was subtle.
Not subtle at all, no. People talk about the love triangle between, Logan, Scott, and Jean, but they don't remember that it was a very one-sided thing where Wolverine was pretty much just crushing on Jean. She did not reciprocate in any way whatsoever, and it was never implied that she might be tempted or would leave Scott for Logan.
It's been retconned, but in some of the the classic X-Men stories, the reprints, they would go that way. But I never saw it in the original. I didn't read that as a subtext. I just saw it as an unrequited love thing.
Just a way to torment Wolverine, basically, just to give a little bit more added dimension to him, where he's kind of, you don't expect that he's going to be the type of character who's going to pine for someone, and he is, and I mean, it's just a complete lost cause. That's pretty much the way that I read it and the way it was supposed to be interpreted.
Yeah, absolutely. It adds to the tragedy of that character too. So in Japan, they are about to be, I think, arrested, and then who turns up but surprising U.S. diplomat Misty Knight.
Colleen, was it Misty or Colleen?
No, it's actually Misty. So Misty's in back-to-back episodes on different continents.
Coincidence.
And then she calls Iron Fist, and I don't know what she's talking about, but I do know there's a little one-panel Iron Fist phone conversation here.
And does she fail to mention to Scott that Jean is actually still alive?
Still alive.
And they're living together?
I have to assume so. I have to assume they talk about that, and so they're fine.
Well, but I don't think they do, because a little bit later, Scott and...
That's right. No, Scott doesn't know. They don't say anything.
No, because Scott gets... He hooks up with somebody else who we're going to see soon.
Yeah. So that's... Back-to-back issues. I wonder if that's an editorial issue or if there just was an intentional, supposed to be a misdirection, supposed to be a...
Yeah, I think it was just a bit of dramatic irony, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe there was a little bit of a time shift, too, because you can't... It was just a couple weeks away, a couple months away.
Sure, yeah.
Cool. Well, it turns out that Moses Magnum is coming after them, and the Mandroids... And that's actually a good place to leave off. I think we're going to have to resume this eventually. So
sure.
So this will be a long series for us, the Byrne Claremont X-Men era. Instead of just one show where we can encapsulate 35 issues in an hour,
I was going to say, yeah, let's not shortchange it.
I'm ambitious, so we got through nine of them with a couple yeah. guest art. So I've had a really good time talking with you about these, Tim.
Me too.
Yeah, it's good dredging up good memories from the past and looking in depth at these classic stories that shoot. I guess I haven't looked at up close in a long, long time, but they're books that changed comics forever.
Yeah, a lot of fun for me too. Anytime you want to do it again, revisit this stuff, and
we will
wrap it up. Just yeah. I will be available.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll slide into each other's DMs, and we'll figure out when we'll we'll do Claremont Byrne Part 2. We don't have to do the. We can forego the initial interview part. We can just get to work on the X-Men for the next show. So that'll work.
Yeah. Cool. How about it? All right. Well, thank you for having me, Todd. It's been a privilege and an honor.
Thank you for coming on. Is there a new issue or a new episode of Survey Says coming soon?
That's a monthly show that Andy Helene and I do, looking back on what we would consider the glory days of WCW, which some of it is rather inglorious, but it's all in good fun.
Pre-NWO, or what's your kind of cutoff?
Pre-NWO, NWO, and post-NWO, we don't discriminate. Pretty much from, I mean, we on our second show, we blew through, we thought we had an ambitious task before us doing this this classic comics run, but Andy and I blew through all the Starcades on our second episode.
Every single Starcade.
Yep, every single. we shortchanged a few, don't get me wrong. But yeah, we, you know, our wheelhouse is pretty much 90s, from early 90s through late 90s, the closure of the promotion. But that's a monthly show we do. Usually drops kind of at the beginning of the month. You'll be looking for that, I would say next episode, early December. Our last show that we did was with our compatriot, Greg Phillips, and we looked at the career of Sting in WCW, which, we had a lot of fun with that. Currently available now, went up, I don't know, probably week or two back.
Yeah.
So track that down on the Place to Be Nation main feed.
Right. We are on the pop feed now. That's on the main, which is wrestling only, but it's not pro wrestling only, which I've learned is a different feed. So there are many feeds, but Survey Says has a proud home on the Place to Be Nation network. And so I will see you next time. The next show I do will be with you, and we will start, we'll pick it up on X-Men 119. Featuring Moses Magnum against everybody except for Beast and Jean Grey, basically.
Yeah. All right. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you, Tim Capel.
Thank you, Todd. I am a passenger.
cities, ripped bare sides. We'll see the bright and hollow sky. We'll see the stars that shine so bright. A stars made for us tonight. Does he see? He sees a sight and hollow sky. He sees the stars come out tonight. He sees the city's ripped back sides. He sees the winding ocean drive. And everything was made for you and me. All of it was made for you and me. But it just belongs to you and me. So let's take a ride. Glass. He looks through his window inside. He sees the things he knows.